three of them end to end. And he said, well, I'll be cutting you open in 5 years. I said, you know, I'm healthy now. Never had a heart attack. Let's do this. So next thing you know.
They got in there and.
First thing you know, old Jeb's a millionaire. And I go, whoa, this is heavy.
Well, here we go.
Here we go.
Today is Thursday, October 19th, 2017. It is 9 a.m., or that's what we're saying. It is the Josephine County Board of Commissioners convening for administrative workshop. We've got a pretty good agenda here today. We start out with the pleasure of having our district attorney here with item number 1A, acceptance of amendment to Violence Against Women Act grant number VAWA dash C dash 2015, Josephine County DAVAP dash 00009 between the Department of Justice and Josephine County to extend grant award period 6 months and add $43,950 to the award. Commissioner Morgan is in the building on her way and will be joining us here shortly, but I think you can start.
Thank you.
She's probably pretty familiar with this.
Yes, I imagine that she is. I'm asking that the county please agree to allow the Department of Justice to extend the Violence Against Women grant that my office gets to prosecute domestic violence cases. They're going to, as you said in the title, they're willing to extend it 6 months and give us an additional almost $44,000, which we use to pay a portion of the salary of one of the deputies who specializes in domestic violence prosecution.
Now you say it's a 6 month extension. Do you have to apply for this all the time, or
every 2 years, sir?
Every two
years.
Yes,
yes. And so we just submitted our application 2 weeks ago for the next 2 year cycle.
Okay.
And we haven't heard back whether or not we've been accepted. Of course, our fingers are crossed, and we did everything that we could do to try and get that award, but we do not know yet. But this would be an extension of the prior,
okay.
The existing, like the commissioner
said. So do they not overlap?
That's what I was wondering, too.
They kind of do. Why they're taking a while to send us this payment, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
It's the Department of Justice.
Sure. Oh, we've worked with
the operation and
the renovations of the courtrooms.
So yeah,
that's
yeah.
been real fun.
We're just very happy to get the money if we can.
Right. We're
yes.
we're in favor of this. It seems as an extension, it'll be a consent calendar item, and happy to speak to it. Who's the liaison to the DEA?
I am, and it was one of those things because the original was signed by all three is why we had to have it come before the full board. Otherwise, I would have signed it and said,
four
great.
Degrees under the authority for, but they don't want you to just.
Well, no, they could have had me just sign. They asked for that, but the extension is under the 50,000 threshold, but the original was greater than and signed by the full board.
Okay.
So I apologize for the extra week's delay in that.
No, understood.
And then item number B is acceptance of child abuse multidisciplinary intervention grant number CAMI-MTTDT 2017 Josephine County DAVAP-00036 between the Department of Justice and Josephine County for $220,632.40 from July 2017 till June 30th of 2019 to fund prosecution and advocacy services for victims of child abuse. Pretty important issue and something you're passionate about.
Yes,
Malcolm.
Yes, sir, yes. This grant my office has been receiving for, I think, 22 years. It comes from the state of Oregon. The money goes to pay for a portion of the deputy district attorney who is assigned to the child physical and sexual abuse caseload, which that was my job for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am very passionate about that type of work. And it also goes to pay for a portion of the salary of Tina Stafford, who is the director of our child advocacy center here in Josephine County.
She's great.
She is. She is a wonderful person. And it also goes to pay for Dr. Kevin Multeny, who is our designated child abuse doctor. Although the amount of money he gets, I doubt, covers the actual amount of time that he provides in service. He just is a great man and a very, very experienced pediatrician and a child abuse doctor. We're very lucky to have him. But that's where all the money goes. It's a two-year grant, and so we're seeking to renew it for another two-year cycle.
Excellent. This is a pretty important issue in our county. Have you Do you find a trend associated with this? Is it, are we making progress, or is it just a hold 'em as it goes, kind of a steady thing? And you feel as though it spiked up a couple of years ago. It just seemed like you were on case after case and state-renowned size cases.
Yes, we, you know, I can't speak for other counties, but I can say that we get child physical and sexual abuse cases here in Josephine County that are just horrible, and the scope and breadth of the sex abuse that some of our kids endure, it's hard to believe that it's real, but it is. And so whether or not we get more per capita, I just don't know. I know that we have a lot here. It keeps us very busy. And I've just seen in my, I've been going on 11 years as a prosecuting attorney now, and it seems like crime, and Mr. Gallagher's back here, and he might even, second me on this. You get kind of like these spikes in criminal activity, certain types of criminal activity, and you work hard to deal with it, and then things will calm for a little bit. And then it will spike again, and it's just like maybe a phenomenon. I don't know.
A new wave of customers.
It could be. I'm not a sociologist and haven't, tried to really study that issue, because we're just so busy trying to keep our head above water dealing with the cases that we know happened and came in and need to be dealt with. But that's just kind of anecdotally what I have seen.
I have not been a liaison to LIPSC for the 7 years that I've been in office here. I just wonder, do you guys talk about this? In 7 years, there have been times when groups have come before the board and said, if we had 60,000 here, we could do this or whatever. I think the child element is something that, the board really hasn't been engaged in the kinds of discussions I think that maybe happen at LIPSC to say, where are more resources? Maybe where are the holes? And what would it take to shore up some of those holes to where the board can do a cost-benefit analysis if there were a little bit of extra general fund dollars available for a match grant or to shore up the difference in how these systems could be more effective? I feel like there's stuff happening in our schools. And I have a friend that I work out with, and she tells me the things that she sees on a regular basis in the schools. And I wonder how do they find the nexus of these kids who are raising kids, they're middle schoolers, raising their younger siblings because their parents are tripped out, drunk, doing silly stuff, and not being the right parents. And I just feel like, I know that there's people who want to help in that system, and there's, it just feels like there's cracks, and where could we... There'll never be enough resources.
I agree. That's a really interesting issue. That'd be a valuable conversation to have at a LIPSC meeting, to get input from all of the people working in the system. I think when we see the terrible cases of neglect, particularly, those are usually the product of parents who are battling addictions, like methamphetamine and tar heroin.
Sure.
And so, is it the chicken or the egg? Where do you start? You know where you want to end. You don't want any kids to suffer. You don't want that to happen. Where do you start along the process to prevent that result? That's a good question.
I know it's probably something
answer for you right
back
now.
Of your mind all the time. But
I
hosted a meeting 2 years ago of every child related program we could think of, to get them in a room, and it was really, it was funny. It wasn't funny. There were people who were working on these issues. Their heads are down. They're ready to go. They're doing stuff, and they had never met some of the other people in this community who were working on those issues. And I thought, if we could get together just once or twice a year for an hour or two and talk about commonalities, duplications, holes in the system, I just feel like there could be a lot of, and I know nothing. Nothing about these systems.
When it gets to this level, it's already gone farther than it should have been, because you've got little kids having babies. And I've heard of girls that said, I'm pregnant, and her girlfriend says, I'm going to get pregnant too, so we can both raise our kids together. Mm. And you have a society that thinks that's perfectly okay, and the kids think that's perfectly okay, that cranking out babies is just something so you have a dolly to play with. That is the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of, because eventually reality sets in. The doll doesn't cry, but the baby does. And then you get into some abuse cases on that side of it. But we need to go farther up the stream and educate then, so that we don't have unwanted children. Yeah, I agree, the drug thing. And as the drug thing continues on and on and on, it used to be, well, now the guy's an alcoholic. Well, now he's a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. And that really affects everything. So it's bigger than, by the time it gets to this level right here, the abuse level and the victims of child abuse, it should have been corrected way ahead of that.
Yeah.
My goal with raising this issue was not to put any more pressure on your shoulders. You have plenty as it is. It's just,
how do you arrive at this $220,000? Is that just the amount of the grant that you can apply for?
Yeah.
They post that once a year or every other year that this is what you're eligible for?
Yes.
How does that change? In other words, you say, well, no, I could use $320,000. Do you apply for $320,000 or is this just all they offer?
That's what they offer. And this is an interesting fact, but these grants are supposed to go to support county child abuse advocacy centers, but Salem is aware of the unique financial situation in our county, and so they make an exception for us to use some of that money to fund a prosecutor. Nothing can get done in a child abuse case unless you have a trained lawyer going into court to work the case through the system. Because, we live in a great country and we have great freedoms and people have constitutional rights, and so one person just doesn't get to make the decision that would end abuse or hold an abuser accountable. There is a very complex legal system, and you have to have an attorney go into court and work that case through the system. So thank goodness that concession is made for us.
So on that note, just to give you an update, some of the things going on in our community, and it may have been a result of your meeting a couple years ago, our foster kids is joined with Parkway, who has the Royal Family mm-hmm. Kids program. They're working together from some programs. The faith community has stepped up in the last couple years to try to reach families before they enter the foster care system. So there's two programs going on in the community, one called Every Child, and the other one's called Safe Families. And the Safe Families one are folks that are headed towards foster care, but they're willing to kind of get mentored by a family and say, all right, we're going to come in and intervene and see how we can help and just kind of offer some guidance. It's slow going. Jackson County's getting a lot more referrals than Josephine County so far, but there's some efforts made. And then through AOC, Mary Sterrett and I, who's the Yamhill County Commissioner, have been trying to make some strides through the Health and Human Services Committee and also through DHS on trying to address some of the issues in our foster care system. Our foster care parents in our community do not feel very supported, and people that are longtime experienced foster parents are ready to stop. And it's a systemic problem statewide. Representative Stark has also been a part of those conversations and trying to get some things going, so trying to find supports to the system. And the new DHS head offered that he thinks that there'll be changes with the new child welfare head that just got appointed last week, but it's still going to...
It was very encouraging hearing him at AOC mm-hmm. about it. Like I said, I don't know very much about these programs, but...
Foster parents deserve all the credit in the world because they're performing such a valuable service, and a lot of the children that they take in are not easy children to raise. You know, they come from situations that are not pleasant, and so they have behavioral issues and things like that. I'm speaking in generalities, and so to take on that task is something that a lot of people would not do, so they deserve a lot of credit for that because it is a hard job, what they're doing,
Yep. Well, thank you for what you do.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me this morning, and
these
grants are important to my office, so this is a good thing.
We'll get them moving.
Okay.
Next week.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
I think these are both consent calendar items, and Commissioner Morgan, if you're willing, you'll speak to these. Item number two is Department Business Community Corrections Review and Approval of 2017-2019 Community Corrections Plan. Mr. Gallirand.
Hey, good morning, Commissioners.
Thank you
for having me. There's a lot of content with these next three items, so feel free to ask questions, and I'll try to do my best to answer them. Before you is the Community Corrections Plan, and we're looking for approval for that. We presented that at LIPSC last week. It was passed and approved. It's a very comprehensive plan, and it is a little bit thick here. So I believe you have a copy of it and have had a chance to review it. If there's any questions on there, I'd be more than happy to answer them right now. But I can go into the presentation if you'd like.
I didn't have any. I think okay. Looks like we're on the right trajectory. Your program is growing.
It is.
And just staff and responsibility. Well, maybe not the responsibility, but... And I met with Ryan Johnson, our facilities director, last Tuesday, in talking about potential expansions and a long-term vision of where it is that community corrections could be really better placed. So it's not, from a facility standpoint, it's not too tough to put more money into infrastructure over there because we just put $250,000 on a new roof. But is that the right space for you guys? You know, just evaluating.
Right now, it's adequate for us right
yeah.
now. We are working with Ryan's office, and he's hired an architect mm-hmm. to redesign and come up with some plans that we could look at and consult with. And,
good.
And, so currently we're okay. But as you're well aware, we're growing our personnel by about 20% within the next couple of months. A few of them are in background checks right now. So we're looking to expand our offices just a little bit, which is exciting because we can offer more programming.
Yeah.
We can offer more services to our clientele and to the community and make our community better and safer. So with that, I'll go into...
And also saving taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody in your program isn't in prison.
Right.
And I think that's a huge thing that I just know every time you're here, your whole program is geared towards getting people's lives back in order and saving taxpayers money. And so when people hear a 20% increase in staffing over there, know that that isn't a local tax dollar going there. It's an aversion to a prison dollar, you know, supervising people in our on the system. And guys do good work over there. Caseloads are just crazy per probation officer.
Yeah,
and
they
just
are.
That's one element.
Our overall population has grown. Now we're over 1,000 people that are in the jurisdiction of Josephine County Community Corrections. And
wow.
There's a lot of different factors that are contributing to that number. And I think DA Mulkins was alluding to some of that information in terms of spikes in crime and mm-hmm. different things. So.
Okay.
This is a budget that is $11.3 million and some change over the next two biennium. It has increased from some state fundings, and we got $1 million more this biennium from grant and aid, which is the community corrections allotment. That doesn't just happen by accident. There's a lot of effort that goes into educating legislators, mm-hmm. into lobbying at the Capitol building, and Josephine County, all of our practitioners are well aware of how that funding stream comes to fruition, and so we make sure that every one of our risk assessments are complete and up to date because the state does a snapshot on our populations and the risk that they have in the local community. So last biennium, it was 2.87% of the overall community corrections allotment for the state. This biennium, it's 2.99%, so it increased from last biennium, which equated to about $1 million more for us.
Wow.
In this particular budget, we got approval for a few more grants, the BGA grant, as well as the drug court grant from the CJC, which is in our budget. A lot of that money is pass-through money, but we are receiving some money for a half-time drug court position, and that is specific to the field services unit.
We approved that last week.
Yes.
We approved it recently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two weeks ago. Yeah. Yeah, so that's in our budget. There's some other smaller items that we have with the fees. They're not specifically accounted for within the detail section of the budget, so I'd like to go over some of those fees, if you will, just to get them on public record. But the other fees that are in your packet, some of them are court-collected jail assessment fees, community service fees, home detention fees, sex offender treatment fees, DUI evaluation fees, housing fees, drug court participation fees, the BJA grant, which is not included in the write-up for the other grants. It's just called, in one line item, other grants, and that's specific to the drug court BJA grant, which is different than the CJC grant for $569,000. We have other funding for work crew contracts that we have with the state, parks now, with city parks, with county parks, also with ODOT alongside the road, so that gives us additional funding.
It's always interesting to see our van in Jackson County cleaning up I-5 or something like that.
There is a little bit of overlap.
Yeah, they're paying for it, so.
Right.
Well, they get on I-5 to clean, but they have to go all the way to Jackson County to come back, so they just kind of give.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a neat partnership to keep our roads clean. As you're well aware, we extended that contract out to 10 years this last year, so that was neat to see. We also have an OHA, Oregon Health Plan reimbursement that is $240,000 that we receive. OHA housing assistance, $57,000, and A&E prevention funds for $80,000, with a total of $887,000, and that's included in the other category, and so that's the breakdown for those funds. But all in all, it's a little over $11.3 million for the next 2 years to community corrections. We did, on this, I should highlight this as well, from what I understand, the sheriff's budget equates to $1 million that they're anticipating to receive from community corrections. We've increased that to $1.2 million for the upcoming biennium. Sheriff Daniel is well aware of that, so he'll be making some sort of a budget adjustment or proposal to the board.
Are those simply SA beds or 1145 beds?
They're for sanctioning beds. Currently, we're at a little over 30 people that are in the jail right now for community corrections that are under our jurisdiction, and so we're recognizing that there is a high need. There's some other things that are going on with the justice reinvestment, as you're aware of, Commissioner, for increasing some more money to the jail out of the JRI, and so the justice reinvestment at about $488,000 for the secure treatment, which gives us 10 beds additionally, and that's a very good program. We're also requesting to have roughly $500,000 out of the JRI, and this is in addition to the CCA plan that goes into the sheriff's budget, and that's going to be voted on October 26 by the CJC. So there's a lot going on in terms of funding from the state into Josephine County, and we're excited about all the opportunities to offer services.
You had mentioned something about the program in the jail.
Yeah.
Either expanding? I'm not really sure. I was over there from a facility standpoint a week or two ago and talking about the female population also needing some of those services, but there isn't an opportunity for both programs, or there could be, or something like that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, just the layout of the jail
limits your ability to.
It does limit it a little bit, because what we have is we have the 900 block, which is far removed from general population.
Yeah.
It's actually down the hallway in the jail. And so that's where the males are housed for secure treatment. And then we also have a classroom that we utilize for cognitive behavioral therapy,
right,
treatment, and so on and so forth, that's also disconnected from the general population. And so just logistically, it's difficult to do that, but it is something that we've talked about at Lipsick, that there is a need. I just don't know how that will.
Because you guys utilize that classroom, they're in there.
They're
for
in
a while.
There four hours a day. Yeah. So it's a high need, high risk population that they need that separation in order for them to feel safe to talk about things that are pertinent to them, and that's one of the reasons why just logistically it's difficult to have those conversations.
You would almost need another pod just dedicated to a female treatment component. Because one of the things about the 900 block pod for the secure treatment is they get some incentives in there. Mm-hmm. They get inmate worker credit time. There's a TV incentive that they've lost access to if there's problems going on. And they go in that classroom. Well, those classroom hours accommodate meals and court times and all that other kind of stuff. So it's not like there's just two other hours in the morning or afternoon you can ask women to do it. But potentially, if there was another pod, they could house the women and do the classroom in the same area. But it's still one of those things. There's just not the space for it, utilizing some of that space. But
I wonder, I'm sure this isn't a totally new idea, but thinking of our population and managing it on a regional basis to where we have that ability, not here, but females in that program could go to Jackson County and we just house those that do not, or vice versa. If they don't have that program, you know, we sub out, you know, and it's not costing anybody necessarily anymore, but you're able to facilitate people. Everybody in the female pod is in this program, so you kind of make it. Because we don't have it.
We did the program in Jackson County before we opened ours, and there was quite a lot of logistical issues with releases and transport back and forth.
That would be crazy.
To speak to that piece of it as well, the Department of Corrections is completely separate from what I'm here to speak
about. It often happens.
Do you have enough women population to justify something like Commissioner Morgan is saying? Is there a breaking point? Say, well, we've got 30 people involved in the program? Or?
There's roughly 30% of our overall population is female that we have jurisdiction over. We're currently doing women-specific risk assessment. It's called the WARNA. We just started a female program within Josephine County Community Corrections. And so right now we're kind of in the beginning stages to move towards getting more and more resources to gender-specific clientele. And so,
but you have to have documentation to justify that.
Right.
You just can't say, hey, we need that. You have to build a case.
That's right. I feel like we need to. So we're just in the beginning stages of community corrections, compiling some of that information, building some of the programs. One of the programs that we have is it's called Moving On, and that is a female-specific cognitive behavioral therapy curriculum that we're instituting, and we have a PO that's dedicated just to that program in conjunction with our treatment counselor. So we would build a case for that. I think anecdotally, it's a need that we could justify later if we wanted to explore that possibility. But there is a partnership with the DOC in Jackson County as people that are being released from prison to spend like their end days in Jackson County's treatment facility and then be released to Josephine County. They also have some agreements with, I think it's Greyhound, to transport them over here to drop them off, and then Welcome Home Oregon meets them and make sure that they, you know, the transition is smooth. So those things are being worked out and talked about.
I do have one budget question for you. I apologize. In looking at the Exhibit A for treatment services, it's page 74 in our packet, but the case specialist budget is more than the supervisor in treatment. And I'm not sure. I was just curious why that is.
74, it could be.
And here, let me not leave you in the dark, and let me switch this for you.
Yeah, I don't want to guess on that.
So up here, just looking at the case specialist position, it's actually greater than the treatment supervisor right below it.
Yeah, I'll have to double check on that with with Angie. It could be that there's another funding stream that's coming in there that, to help pay for it,
okay.
The remainder. But I'll have to double-check on that, Commissioner, and get back to you.
Anything else?
Not for the CCA plan, but...
I just had one question. Are you adjusting any of your fees this year? Okay.
No, we're really focusing on actually collecting the fees that are outstanding, because including restitution.
Mm-hmm.
So we just made a really strong effort to collect restitution, especially the ones that kind of fall through the cracks. They're low risk to commit crimes, but they still have balances on restitution that we're trying to collect and get the victims paid back. And so that's a... We're not increasing our fees, but we're increasing the focus. Yeah.
On the restitution thing, is that county by county? In other words, if a judge in Douglas County demanded restitution, you don't collect that here, they do up there?
It transfers to us, so yeah,
it does.
We would collect it for them. Yeah.
And we need a conversation.
They pay through the courts where the conviction happened, but we're the ones that put the pressure on the individual and where they supervise.
But if that individual never comes back to Josephine County, then you have nobody to go contact. How do you do that?
It's in the jurisdiction. If it was in Douglas County and they lived in Douglas County and were supervised in Douglas County, the only pressure that we could really give is to call that jurisdiction and tell them, hey, this citizen in our jurisdiction is making a complaint against this offender or perpetrator of this crime, and so would you please put some more effort into collecting restitution
If a criminal did something here, got caught in Douglas County, and then was released and came back here,
yeah.
He falls under your umbrella.
Yeah, yeah. Then the
But if he goes somewhere else, you don't know where he went. And
Then a warrant goes out, and then they get arrested, go into maybe it's a secure treatment, and then we start talking about transitioning out to the public and then doing case planning for restitution collection.
I just didn't know how much it came home to roost to where you're saddled with it again. You know, in collection. I've dealt with collection agencies, and that's not a fun job. I mean, trying to search these people out, find out where they went, what they're doing now, so on and so forth. Unless something triggers where they want a home loan or something like that, you'll never find them. You'd never hear from them again.
Well, in every payment, if they do make a payment to the courts, only 50% goes to restitution in each payment. So say they're on a payment plan paying $25 a month, only $12.50 goes to restitution.
Yeah.
And the rest gets split out to the other court costs. And, I mean, it could be a lifetime of that person paying back their restitution.
Item number two?
Yes, item number two.
Intergovernmental agreement number 5432 with Oregon Department of Corrections and Josephine County for alcohol and drug treatment services.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is for Measure 57 grants, and if you look back a little bit of the history, is that Measure 57, I think it was 2008, the voters passed that property crimes meeting a certain threshold, as well as ID thefts and some drug-related crimes, would go to prison. With that measure did not come a whole lot of funding. It's an unfunded mandate for those folks to go to prison. So these funds are to directly impact that population in treatment. So we use all of the $320,000 directly to our in-house treatment program, and they deploy all of the treatment funds for that. And so
that's to keep people out of the prison system.
That's to keep people out of the prison system, yeah. And it's directly linked to treatment. So that's what those Measure 57 dollars are for. There's a very comprehensive and detailed plan to target that population and get them the therapy that they need, including wraparound services for accountability with POs and holding them to those conditions of supervision.
So is the state finding that program successful?
Yes, they are. In fact, our allotment for the Measure 57 funds from 2015 to 2017 was $296,000 last time, and now it is $320,000. So the state is finding value in the Measure 57.
Is that in direct relation to your accounting, your record keeping?
It is, because the 2.99% that I went over last time for the allocation rate, that's the same allocation rate for the CCA funds of the $8 million or more that we're getting, also the Measure 57 funds that we're getting, as well as the Justice Reinvestment Funds that we're getting. So our practitioners are very well versed in how that calculation happens with the snapshots on October 1st, November 1st, and December 1st, and we make sure everything is entered in properly so we can get those funds to Josephine County. So, yes, it is attached to that.
Great. Item number 3 is Intergovernmental Agreement number 5464 with the Oregon Department of Corrections in Josephine County for Community Corrections Grant in Aid Funding.
And that is, there's a lot of overlap here within these three, but that is for specifically the CCA funds within the Community Corrections Plan. So that's the $8.2 million. If you would be so kind to... or $8.179 million. That is within the CCA plan, and that is all money from the state that is being allocated to us. So that we're just asking that you
accept
that.
Sounds good.
That funding.
And what's amazing is when I was hired in 2005, I was on the slate to be laid off within a year, because at that time we had been receiving $1 million from general fund and would be going to a system of no funds from the general fund in the future. And every year it was like, okay, you might get laid off, you might get laid off, and somehow survived it. But it's when they moved into Marie Hill as well. I mean, we had gone through massive cuts through attrition and various things, and so it's just... to see the growth and to see the programs and everything that you're accomplishing is pretty amazing. So.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I'm impressed.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Gowran.
Okay. The last thing that I'll leave you, and I didn't bring three copies, but this is a letter to the Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections, mm-hmm. and it just outlines the funding for Measure 57 and where those funds will go. So
okay.
I'll leave that with my liaison.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Right.
All righty. Item number 3 is quarterly department updates. We've got transit.
Morning.
Morning.
Morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you? I have a few items on here. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but if there's something specific somebody wants to ask me questions about, feel free to jump in.
Yeah.
So the first item up is obviously what we do. It's our ridership. Ridership had been going down the last year or so. We were down to about 1% to 2% less from the year before. So far this fiscal year, we've turned it around, so it's about 6% growth. And this month, actually, it's I think we're up 25% over October of last year. So there might
school is that you relate that to the college or college
yes,
starting?
Yes, yes, yeah. Part of it's because of the college. And the reason the percentage might be high or that high is because maybe last year I didn't look. Maybe October of last year there was only 21 operating days. This year there's 22, but still 25% increase is incredible.
It's really interesting this morning coming up 7th Street. There was probably 10 people waiting by the Riverside Park bus stop, and I thought that was really great. Yeah, that's the most I've seen. And they're all, half of them look like business professionals going to work.
Yeah.
And it was really, it's like, I think people are finding out that that's a program that they can rely on the bus system to be there, ready to go, get you to work on time.
This is off target, but do you have anything going up in the Hawthorne area? Because I, you know, there are so many people that drive to work at those dental and medical things up there. They've got that. There's just all on free parking, and during the middle of the day, it's tough to get two cars in between there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't know if there was a stop up there somewhere in that vicinity.
The closest we get to Morgan, so we're about four blocks away from all of those medical facilities. But I have targeted that area as something that we need to look into.
Yeah.
It's growing. So
for patients and for, you know, patients and for employees.
Yeah, that was a classic example of they'll build it and hopefully we come. So they just built it, and then after it was said and done, they're like, hey, can you get a service here? And it's just, that's not the easiest way to work through things, but I definitely identified it. So getting real quick back to the ridership. So if you look at the last four of the last 5 months, the riderships for that month has been the highest it's ever been. So we've definitely, something's going on. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with the large buses and having a better community presence. Obviously, because we only operate Monday through Friday at this point, people don't see it as a long-term option. So you do see people come in and out of the system, but I think they go and try to find other options or something of that nature, and then they come back. And so it's just kind of cyclical in nature, but we're on the upside of this, and so here we go again. So, which is interesting considering that we would be looking at increasing service because of the transportation funding package. It just went through. So pretty happy about that. The other thing I really wanted to talk about is this transportation network company. It's also known as Uber, Lyft. I was at a Public Transportation Association conference, their annual conference. It was in Pendleton, and Uber actually had a representative there. And I didn't actually talk to the individual, but they stated that they are going to be starting in Medford, the middle of October, which is interesting because I hadn't heard that. I knew that they had talked to the city council, but the most interesting part of that conversation, as it was relayed to me, is they also had plans to come into Grants Pass. And I figured that if they were planning on coming into Grants Pass, they probably would have talked to the county commissioners or the city of Grants Pass itself. That hasn't happened, as far as I'm aware. But the interesting part of this is we've already started this transportation network company analysis to see how they'll integrate with transit. So it was very timely that we got that grant or that planning program underway. That I have a consultant.
Why do they have to ask us? I've always wondered, you know, they go into, well, maybe cities, but nobody else comes to the board and says, hey, we want to open up a blah, blah, blah.
But I know at the city, if they were going to start a taxi company, it had to be approved by the city council.
But to have a business.
I think there's a franchise aspect to it.
And a fee and a background check. But
yeah, you know, because you're...
Well, there's different
Uber
policies.
Uber isn't
different.
A taxi. Officially, yeah. They're just somebody taking a ride and happens to share a ride along the way is how they try to get around that.
Well, it's pretty strict. I mean, when we were on council, I don't know how many times they brought a taxi driver. You know, had a little bit of a smudge on his record. He had to go before the city council to get approved to be a driver.
That's why Uber's different.
Yeah.
Or Lyft, or I mean, I don't know exactly what their internal criteria is, but I don't.
I think based on prior practices and just their notoriety, they have a practice of going to the governing body and saying, "Hey,
yeah,
we're coming into town. Do you have any concerns?" Because they also know that there typically is a backlash from the existing taxi companies.
Eugene put a 2-year moratorium, right, on Uber mm-hmm. when they did something they didn't like. Or mm-hmm. there was a child, an underage kid that was put in an Uber, and neither the Uber driver nor the kid ever made it to the destination, never seen again.
No, wow.
Wow.
And I think that's because Uber didn't want to do background checks or something like that. And the city council of Eugene said, if you're not willing to do background checks on your people, you are not going to be operating in Eugene. So
Uber, I thought they do background checks.
I think
they're supposed to.
Huh.
It was the level of a background check.
Correct.
There was doing a cursory, you are Dan DeYoung.
Yeah.
I think that's perfectly understandable because you know what? You should have reasonable expectations when you call a cab or a bus or any kind of public transportation. You should have a reasonable expectation that you're not getting in the car with a pedophile or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I wouldn't.
We have to with our drivers. They go through an extensive background check, not only with the county, but also one of our one of the brokers that we contract with. So,
did you get them fingerprinted?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, so they go through both systems. And so as far as them coming into town, not sure when, but I'm glad I have this planning program underway. And we're looking at it because there's a lot of things that we would have to meet, or they would have to meet, to do business with us and vice versa. But I definitely think the trend is to be cooperative with them and utilize them in places that we, or they can serve more efficiently than we can in terms of cost effectiveness. So I'm pretty excited about that. So it's on its way, but we'll just see what happens.
It's real interesting.
The other thing I wanted to talk about.
Did you say mid-October?
Yeah.
Of next year?
No, this year.
As in we're there.
We're there.
Yesterday.
Right. Yesterday, by the way. Right. Just, you know,
2 days ago.
And I haven't heard any news of them being in Medford yet, but that's what the guy was saying. So I've seen several emails come through, and we are trying to start dialogue if they would.
And that's an old tactic. You drop the ball on what you want to do, and the press picks it up. And then if your governing body says no, you go, oh my gosh, the public backlash is huge. So that's how you do it. You say, yeah, we're going to be coming to, you know, just like in a number, yeah, we're going to move to Grants Pass. That everybody gets all the hype done, and then they just move in.
Right.
You know, who's going to tell In-N-Out to go away? You know, half a dozen people.
That's exactly
that's
right.
That's a tactic.
So far, there are no Uber drivers in Grants Pass that I'm aware of.
Not yet.
I know somebody that has been waiting to move here for it to come because they do that where they live, and it's just that's enough for them.
Lyft,
to
sure
they do out. Lyft and Uber. They do
it's
them both.
Real complicated, Commissioner DeYoung. You load your credit card in here.
Here, let me show you. It's on my phone.
We'll get you all dialed in. Thanks, Scott.
The next item up is the vehicle replacements. This is something I've obviously been talking about vehicle replacements for quite a long time. Now, with the size of the vehicles that we're going to, it can take anywhere from 12 to 16 months to get a vehicle. I do have CMAQ funds. Here's the question I'm going to pose is, I'm looking at electric vehicles. I've done a lot of research. I've been looking at this for about a year. I'm not ready to pull the trigger yet, but I'm getting really close. So if there's any reservations or questions that anyone has about that, I'd be more than willing to field them either here or at a different session. But because it takes so long to get a vehicle here once it's ordered, and I do need to get vehicles here because with this funding package that's coming through, that's going to be here. If I ordered the vehicles today, that funding would be available before those vehicles were here to implement the service change. So that's kind of where we're at.
Are those battery powered, chargeable type things?
They're 100% battery powered. I'd be looking at a slow charge, which means you plug it in at night. It's slow charges. You plug it in at night, it charges overnight. Now, overnight only means 6 hours. 4 to 6 hours, depending, and all that's determined by how much power actually comes in. So the more power you come in, how you bring in, the faster you can get them charged. But we're typically looking at doing it at night.
Now, where would you do that? Would you do that out of public works or at your facility?
We do it right where we're at right now.
And do you have the service coming in to your facility to operate all the chargers if you have like 4 chargers going at once?
Yes. Well, no. You'd have to pay for that upgrade, and how much that upgrade is I'm trying to determine what the level of power that we're going to need.
Right. No, you got a 200-amp panel, and you can't feed 4 chargers off of a 200-amp panel. I don't know what it would take.
Right. And
load-wise.
I'm not sure either. I'm not an engineer. I'm trying to get some of these companies to help me out in determining that. I have been in talks with Pacific Power, and they have a load estimator that will fill out and then give to them, and then they'll let us know.
Well, I know they had there for a while. They had programs that they were coming. The 2 charging stations that are up by Chamber of Commerce, I think, were on a grant of some sort from Pacific Power, from COPCO, or whoever it was. And, you know, the possibility, you know, you might be able to get into something like that where they put the infrastructure in and you just pay the usage.
That's exactly right. So there's 2 programs out there. There's one through Pacific Power, or it's actually through the Public Utilities of Oregon. They're supposed to put in a program locally. that will encourage the use of alternative fuel vehicles, specifically electricity. So there's the chance, high probability, to get them to pay for the infrastructure. There's also the Volkswagen settlement that's in Oregon that they paid for to use those funds to pay for the charging infrastructure. The charging infrastructure, there's a one-time charge of somewhere between $100,000 and $150,000 to change the power as it comes into your facility. And then the chargers themselves are about $50,000 a piece. But there's a few questions in terms of how many chargers do you actually need. Because if it only takes one charger, if I can charge a bus in 6 hours, I can charge two in 12 hours. I only need one charger.
So there's you need somebody there to switch it, or it switches?
Nope, it gets switched automatically. So
right.
you plug them both in. That's exactly
switches.
Right. And
good.
It monitors the load going into one, and once it reaches 100%, it turns that one off and shifts to the other.
Great.
So there's a few questions that still need to be answered. I'm looking at this is probably going to save $600 a month in pure fuel costs alone.
At today's rate.
For today's rate, what we're paying for diesel and the projected rate that Pacific Power is telling me on their commercial sheets what we pay. There's a chance that that amount that we would pay per kilowatt hour of electricity is actually less if we do it in off-peak. But one of the interesting things I found out, off-peak does not mean off-peak like it meant in my mind. Off-peak means it has to be lower than what your current peak is. And if you look at the power coming into my facility, because it's not all of Public Works, it's just my office, I'm running lights, computers, phones, that's it. So my guess is the amount of power I'm going to be using to power or to charge electric vehicles is more than what I'm using now.
Right.
So there's a few things to investigate looking at that, but I still think that the way that this pencils out, it's a tremendous cost savings. Not only is it $600 a month per vehicle, but there's also tremendous cost savings that you recover through reduced maintenance costs. So they're projecting the maintenance cost is anywhere from $300,000 to $400,000 reduction over the 12-year life of that vehicle.
And do we have somebody on staff that can work on electric vehicles? I mean, it's different than taking the diesel dump truck and putting it in to the shop, and all of a sudden you bring this thing in and open the lid, and there's 72 batteries that have the potential of knocking somebody from here to next week, and they got to know about that stuff.
That's exactly right. So that's the other part that still needs to kind of be looked at is, one, can I get proper support from the manufacturer? Are you kidding? We're Josephine County. I'm going to buy two, maybe up to four electric vehicles. That's not a lot of money to them when they're selling 100 at a time to L.A. Metro or King County Metro.
Mm-hmm. So does Metro have any electric vehicles?
They will not. No. I've actually talked to them, and I did a board presentation for them, and they're committed to compressed natural gas. So the amount of infrastructure that they put in place to support that, they're not necessarily interested to going to electric. They are looking at electric for some of their demand response services, but that's it. So, getting
how many passengers on one of these electric buses? Are they the smaller variety?
It's the same as what we have now.
Okay.
So it's the same as we have now.
I think I'd like to talk about this more and hear that presentation and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, a little bit of background in electricity.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions. Just to quickly answer your question, is somebody on maintenance? No, there's not somebody currently on the maintenance department, but they do bring in training. They offer 2 weeks of training. The new maintenance facility manager also has experience in electric vehicles, so I'm waiting to talk to him when he comes on board. So just kind of some food for thought here. I'm not ready to order anything
today.
It's not
just your program we need to be looking at from a maintenance standpoint. I think, you know, we should find those vehicles that are on, you know, a traditional fuel source right now. If we go with the buses, you'd have to depreciate that training and knowledge, I would think, and I think that would be beneficial over, you know, a broader spectrum of our portfolio of transit, and that should be of transportation. The fleet should be looked at, you know, that there are vehicles that people are using. I'd say public health, planning, building and safety, some of those could be electric vehicles as well, and that would be really beneficial.
I agree, and so it's something that we still need to look into. We do have two mechanics dedicated to the transit fleet mm-hmm. out of the fleet maintenance program. So, but it's just, it's out there. At some point, we keep kind of ticking away here at the clock. We're going to still need to order vehicles.
The focus of what I think I'd like to hear your presentation on is what are the benefits and costs associated with going to electric versus compressed natural gas. I think the mm-hmm. ability to go to for us to evaluate what we can do with the rest of our fleet relative to electric or compressed natural gas. And they don't have a combined system over there in Jackson County. They have their own special district, but we do. We're combined, so it might be one of those things where we want to.
And there's some interesting things going on with the compressed natural gas over there. They're looking at reclaimed compressed natural gas from the landfill.
Mm-hmm.
So the minute that they get that in, it's even
cheaper.
But they're sitting on a landfill right there that they can pump into the existing CNG system. So there's some advantages and disadvantages.
Sure.
That we do.
So, that's good.
The other thing that obviously radio stations listen to these meetings, because I got an email three weeks ago from RCC, and apparently the student pass program was picked up by Cato Radio, and they ran a little article, and the article was not even close to the truth. They didn't let the facts get in the way of their article. So just want to quickly clarify that. RCC, actually, the student pass program, those students buy a pass or buy a sticker from RCC, students and staff. They put that sticker on their student ID, and that allows them to board our vehicles for free. They're not riding for free. They're boarding for free because they've already paid for that ability by buying that sticker. So just kind of wanted to clarify that real quickly. And then the last thing on my meeting or my notes here for my report is Greyhound. And I don't know if you're aware, Greyhound moved. They moved from Agnes Avenue, Terry Lane, then they moved to Terry Lane at the Arco station. And then they promptly got somehow kicked out of there. So then it became an urgent situation for them to find a new place to stop in Grants Pass. And they called the city of Grants Pass on a Friday and said, we need somewhere to start stopping at, and we need to know it now because we need to change it by Monday. That put some undue pressure on the city of Grants Pass, and they just kind of made some decisions and didn't think about it. But what they ended up doing was moving to Morgan Lane up on the north end of town, because it's already designated as a loading-unloading zone for freight vehicles.
The transfer site, right across from Bentwood Furniture.
Right, and that's exactly right. So Southern Oregon Aspire is also right there. So they moved into there and proceeded to promptly commandeer our stop. So they were stopping at our bus stop, and their passengers were using our facilities, which is fine. I'm okay with that. But with Greyhound, you had people that were sitting there for hours at a time interfering with our ability to provide service to our passengers. Their vehicles were pulling up, not where the city told them to, but were pulling up directly to our stop and blocking our vehicle's ability to not only get by them on the street, but our drivers couldn't even see the stop. So then there was a conflict with passengers as to, hey, which vehicle do we get on? There was some confusion. So after a considerable persistent complaining on my end, I got the city to clarify the situation and restripe the area. But that's still, it's working, but this Greyhound is still does pretty much whatever they want, and they're stopping still at our stop.
Is there any way we can go to Mr. Reeves, because this is probably David Reeves, the guy that's right behind this thing, and tell him, you know, it's only a temporary fix. Find another place for your bus, because it conflicts with something we've already had in our route system, approved route system, approved by the board, that you need to, you're there for today, but what's your plan? And when is it, and what's the date certain you're going to be gone from there?
That's exactly right, and I've made myself very clear on that. It is alleged a temporary situation for Greyhound. They had 6 months approval, but they said they would get it fixed in 2 months. Fixed means getting it completely out of there. I don't think the city understood the land use implications of passenger loading and unloading. It's not the same as freight, because all those passengers have to get there one way or another. So there's people parking all over the place. There's people walking into Southern Oregon Aspire asking to buy tickets asking to use their restroom, asking if they can have some cardboard so they can put it down so they can lay in the grass. There's, and you're talking a facility that's hired people with
developmental disabilities.
It's really strange for somebody to just walk into their workplace and start. So there's a lot of issues going on. I'm willing to let it go for this temporary situation, but this can't be permanent. So the reason I wanted to bring it up is to let the commissioners know if we roll past this three-month period of time, I'm going to be even more persistent that they move.
Well, as your liaison, don't hesitate to call me because
I will. Yeah, I won't.
He's happy to walk over. He knows.
So hopefully that situation gets resolved.
Of the resolution could be us making a suggestion about this is the more appropriate place to have a Greyhound bus stop. I think looking at other cities, I've only taken the Greyhound maybe once or twice in my life, but it seems as though they drop you off in sketch areas. And it would be ideal if it wasn't such a sketch area in Grants Pass.
No,
light and, yeah. You know, the right spot is really key.
Well, near a market where they can go in and buy some food if they want and not be dependent on,
wait. Walmart seems to encourage, you know, that outer parking lot at Walmart, that's their motorhome parking.
They used to. They don't do that. I don't think that they're real excited about that anymore. I think they used to. Okay. But that was my thought exactly, is Walmart maybe behind it by
the
jail.
Yeah, it's well lit and plenty of place for the bus to turn around and pick a corner of Walmart parking lot and go from there.
Put it behind Walmart so when people get out of jail and they say, go catch the bus back to...
I had that conversation with somebody at another agency the other day, but I told...
It's true.
I told the city, you know, out of the worst places they could possibly pick to put the stop, they picked probably the 9th or the 10th. I could find 15 other locations for them that were more compatible than what they picked. So I'll continue to work with
them. I'm surprised it didn't end up down the historic business, central business.
That's number 10.
That's another subject.
Or Dutch Bros headquarters.
Yeah.
They've got that drive-through. It used to be a bank.
Good coffee while you're there.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's all I have. Okay. Any questions?
I think we'd be willing to help facilitate some sort of an opportunity back there by the jail. I think that makes a lot of sense. That location of town, it's got plenty of room for stuff, and it's the right spot. So I'm interested in, you know, helping out. It's Greyhound does good service and stuff, so let's put them in the right spot.
Greyhound traditionally, and this is not only my opinion, but it's supported by a considerable amount of evidence, is not the best community partner you could work with.
No.
But
we have to read across the aisle.
That's
exactly where you're going to go.
That's exactly right.
You're doing the great shakeout.
Okay.
So,
is it 10 or 10:30?
10:19, so we have 15 minutes.
Okay.
Two things.
Okay.
Recently, heard some folks bragging about your drivers. They know them by name. They talk about how kind and polite and friendly. And so I wanted to pass that along to you, that three specific drivers were named, and I can't remember the names that I heard. I thought Shelley was one of the ladies' names, but I can't remember for certain. But it was nice to hear a random conversation of them talking about their drivers personally like that. And rumor on the street is that there's talk of opening a Saturday.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd...
That's fun.
That's how you do it. Exactly how you do it.
Just going to keep...
Wait a minute. Then we just talked about this. Throw it out there and see what happens.
Throw it out there.
Yeah, this Saturday is an extremely high priority. So when this funding becomes available, and actually I will bring a plan back to the board that talks about what our service improvements are going to be, because we have to put it together and file one with the state. And so when we finally come up with, hey, these are our service improvements and here's how they're going to be phased in, I'll definitely bring it to the Board of County Commissioners for approval.
My dream is 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Just saying.
I think we can probably get pretty close.
I'm willing to drive.
As a driver, what shift would you like?
If you give me the training, I'll drive for you.
Late afternoon?
I'm going to remember that because sometimes we do get short on drivers.
Hey.
We volunteer.
She's already pre-qualified. She drove a golf cart at the fairgrounds.
There we go.
Not very good either.
Oh, my goodness. She doesn't say much very often, but by what she does.
Thank you.
See you later.
All righty. Mr. O'Hare. Actually, let's do Hicks first, if that's okay.
Isn't everyone?
We are, too. We proposed adding a whereas.
We did.
I hope somebody remembers it, because I don't.
It was good. It was good.
Whatever it said. What was it?
It was referencing the non-binding ballot question.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
So
good. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So, and then I gathered in the next draft there's going to be potentially some more edits from Commissioner Morgan. And so that's kind of where we left off.
Okay. When's that coming out? Is it already out?
I'm here to
move it to the weekly business session.
Yeah,
next
collect
week.
Commissioner Morgan's thoughts, edits. And did you want to talk about this?
We do. We will.
Okay.
Go.
So from my standpoint, when I first read the letter, I liked the letter. But I got to the last paragraph about there, and I'm going by memory. I don't have it in front of me.
Well, we should have copies. The letter is different than the resolution, and I don't think we took everything from the letter.
I never saw the resolution then. Or maybe I did. I saw something that was a draft that was emailed to me while I was out ill. Councillor Hicks emailed me something to keep me in the loop, and that's all I remember.
We're getting copies right now.
Okay. So I guess where it came down to is and since then, it's something that when I first read it, the portion about calling for the firing of employees, it kind of caught my breath. Now, that's not the right terminology when I read it. But then, you know, I had some folks challenge me on Facebook, and I was kind of defending this and that. But when it came down to it, and I finally put my finger on what my thoughts were on it, is that if somebody came to us and said, I demand you fire that employee, I've even gathered signatures. As we saw earlier this year, somebody gathering signatures to have one of our department heads fired. Quite frankly, I didn't take what they said for merit. I realized that there is a progressive discipline process that we do and due process in employment, and that somebody who comes in and demanding I fire somebody, the question will be, well, what policy did they break? What was their previous history as employment? There's other things in the case, not just, okay, I'm going to fire him because you said to fire him.
I think I hear where you're coming from. I don't think the firing element is in our resolution. So
okay.
Let's just move past what Senator Bertschiger may have said in his. I don't want to call for people. So that's not up to us. They work for that director, the Secretary of Agriculture. They don't work for me. They work for him. He's the one who needs to be held accountable. And the same thing here. The managers, there isn't an employee that works for the people. We are their employee. We hire and they are hire and fire. That's who does it for us. Everybody else works for us. And so, you know, if you're calling for somebody's head, call for the liaison to the community development directors. That's me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll work with it.
And that was for me. I didn't want our messaging to be lost in that goal. Because what is our goal? Our goal, twofold. One, they changed their fault policy about prevention. They have some reduction in fuel so that we can have a manageable fire. My preference would be that ODF be the one that have the contract for all public lands in Oregon, as they do for private and BLM and Oregon lands.
Well, let's just read it real quick. In the matter of expressing no confidence in the U.S. Forest Service management.
Okay, go ahead. I'm with you now. I found where you were reading.
It's English, and I'm starting at the top of the...
We're
just
good.
Giving you a hard time. Where... It's on this side of the room today. Whereas the U.S. Forest Service is responsible for managing 15.6 million acres of public property in Oregon, and whereas during 2017, fires in Oregon consumed nearly 678,000 acres of federally protected lands, which required $340 million in firefighting costs, and whereas unmanaged and undermanaged forests are allowed to become overstocked with increasing fuel loads, creating tinderbox conditions where the likelihood of widespread conflagrations are highly probable. Whereas the U.S. Forest Service past negligent forest management and wildfire initial attack practices have been the most substantial contributing factor in causing the Checo Bar 2017, the Biscuit in 2002, and the Silver Creek Fire in 1987. Whereas the local and regional leadership of the U.S. Forest Service has, through mismanagement, caused severe and massive damage to the health, property, and well-being of this community's citizens. Whereas the governing body of the Josephine County has no confidence in the professional ability of the upper and middle management of U.S. Forest Service's regional districts. It is hereby resolved that the Board of County Commissioners calls upon the U.S. Forest Service to break from this past forest management practices. It is further resolved that the Board of Commissioners calls upon the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, to immediately discharge from public service all U.S. Forest Service personnel who are in part responsible for, through negligence, bad judgment, or otherwise, for allowing the conditions that ultimately result in. I can see that's your paragraph.
In order to leave the teeth in it, can we say, call upon Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue to investigate, look into their...
From everything I've seen, they followed their forest practice. They follow their policy. Their hiring practice says pursue employees that will encourage fire. This is assuming they didn't exactly follow their own procedures, which there would be nothing to fire.
It's a procedure we need to question, not the employees.
What I said from the beginning is I don't fault anybody who's working on this through the Forest Service. The time to have this conversation is when you have a resource management plan that was adopted a decade ago. It's their prescription to do probably what they did on the landscape, and that's different than ODF. Not all these public agencies are the same. It's the prescription for how they manage it and the resource management plan. And they're coming up with doing a new one right now.
Maybe that's what we should address rather than employees.
So, and that's, I agree, that call for Sonny Perdue to, pursue an active prevention plan or something like that to prevent these catastrophic fires. To look at ODF as a fire responding agency that's in the area similar to others, you know, the primary fire responsible in the area, or something like that.
Yeah.
Our goal isn't to just fire employees, because that's all this looks like. Our end goal needs to be a change in practice, a better fire prevention, and preferably that ODF, as the state fire agency that is experts in our terrain and our topography, the weather and circumstances, that they were best suited to make the decisions for fire in our community.
I hear what you're saying, and you're not wrong, Commissioner Morgan.
ODF
is acting within the prescription of the landscape that they're currently having jurisdiction for fighting wildfire in. If they're restricted under the U.S. Forest Service's management scheme for fighting fire the way the U.S. Forest Service is, it was my proposal, you know, a month ago to say you need to have ODF fight your fires.
Right.
And it doesn't matter who you put in place. If you're putting these parameters in a resource management plan under the firefighting agency, that's what you're going to do.
So we want the parameters
that
ODF...
I don't think it's a bad idea to have ODF on the ground doing it.
Well,
anyway, I think what you're going for is...
I'm going to bring up the Shan Creek fire as my example. The Shan Creek fire, where ODF was on scene as a cooperating agency and had it almost lined at 156 acres.
Sure.
They were 800 feet from completion. When U.S. Forest Service said, it's no longer safe for our firefighters, get out, we're going to backburn 2,000 acres.
Yeah.
ODF said, are you kidding? And they were able to pull a, we can act independently here. They finished the 800 feet.
Yeah.
And then said, look, it's lined. Don't do this. They were still planning to backburn the 2,000 feet, even though they had it lined.
1,800 acres, yeah.
And
that's what got Senator Bertrager all fired up. Going up to paragraph 5, where it says local, excuse me, contributing factors, where it's health, property, and well-being, there needs to be an economic impact to that. Because these fires really impact the economy.
To our health, economy, property, and well-being?
Yeah, the economic standpoint, you know, for instance, Shakespeare closing, Hell's Gate shutting down 3 weeks early, so on and so forth. There's a huge economic impact to our tourism industry, which we depend on in Southern Oregon, not to get to that kind of a thing. But I think there needs to be an economic
reference.
You know, massive damage to health, property, and economic facts. I don't know how you word it, but I think I would add an economic aspect to that.
There's a lot we could say. I mean, the numbers and stuff go on and on.
I think the main thing is going to be the title.
And I was thinking about that. Is it Forest Services Management? It's the Forest Service. They manage the forest. So I was thinking fire management, but it really isn't. You have to go back a step. It's the forest management that contributes to these massive
fires. That's a big picture.
I had a stat that somebody told me that 8 animals per acre die in these fires. So if you do the math of 160,000 acres or 200,000, how many animals died in this thing? And, you know, the wildlife, really, I put this all at the feet of the environmental movement that has said, we're going to set it aside and preserve. You just can't do that and let it go.
That's the death knell.
It is. And they need to have some responsibility. They need to be called on the carpet for their perspective. Since the inception of the ONC Act, for 80 years, people have been managing forests, and all of those species were still there because you contributed. They had a sustained yield production where you got it. They reforested. Who's reforesting this? There's no money to do that. There's no resources, and there's no incentive for them.
My big fear is that eventually, this will become normal. Right now, when I was in business, if I saw things going sideways, one of the old things you do is you go back to when did it work? What was happening when it worked? Well, when we were back logging and the logging crews were in the woods and you had fire crews in the woods of college kids out for the summer, so on and so on and so forth, it worked. And I'm afraid that that's so far, that history is so far gone that the new people, like U.S. Fish and Wildlife now, you talk to them about the way it used to be, and they go, I don't even know what you're talking about. I said, well, it's when you could go to Eastern Oregon and have a reasonable expectancy to kill a really nice mule deer. That's gone. Why? And it's because of your wildlife practices of late. But you don't know any other way because you're going to refuse to listen to that history. You will not have a place eventually. You will not have anything to go back on. Commissioner Morgan and I saw that when we were at County College. And I called a young lady on it. I said, the timber industry and the fishing industry did not die of a demise, of their own demise. They were shut down by the ecology people. And I said, and you're trying to pass off that it was their own problem. They were shut down by their outside. They were running along just fine until somebody, the ecology people came back, oh, no, you can't do that anymore. And eventually history will just die off and you will never know what really worked because nobody will be around to say so.
So are we doing this?
To me,
no means to interrupt, but it is 10:19.
Yeah.
Do we get under the table?
We're technically supposed to play the recording for 30 seconds. It's online if we were supposed to do it right.
I'm just supposed to take pictures of you guys under the table.
No, technically to do it right, there's a website you go to, you click the thing, you get under the table while they do the sound, and Mr. Ford is escaping for some reason.
I guess he is.
Yeah, that's true. They're from Clemson.
Yeah, hey.
Well, we might as well get a picture.
All right. So you're supposed to get under and grab onto something.
Is this for earthquake deal?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll shake the table while you're underneath. There you go.
Well, you're supposed to get
under
that way.
Should we get under too, or should we go find a different table?
Find a different table.
You're on your own.
You're supposed to hang on too. You get under anything. Three commissioners. Dan, where's that face?
You got to lean down a little so you can see the camera.
And you smile. That's great.
Okay.
We good?
Yes.
I've
been
Monday
Night Football.
Just
doesn't
get around.
Well, I know what it
was. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm glad Sean Hall's not in the room.
Yeah.
So, if ever there were an earthquake, remember, get under something that'll protect your head. It's the greatest harm is to your head, things falling. So you get under a solid object and hang on.
I don't know why they don't let you stand in the doorway.
It's a myth that that's the safest place now.
I don't think it's safe. It's just going to be behind the table for something
like this.
No, they say for the picture, the doorway is not better. But they say that what they've actually researched is that more people get injured from falling debris. So yeah. That's why they say get under a solid object. So the falling debris hits that, not your head. Then you're crushed, so it's okay.
Right. Then who cares?
Okay. I think we have work to do on this thing, unfortunately. I don't think it's ready for action. So I think I still would. I want to move on it next week. So how do we get this done?
We would potentially, I think when we left off on Tuesday, it was, you and me were going to sit down and kind of put the final touches on it and then get it to Wendy.
I think
Wendy
we've got some good direction. Is that what you're saying? And then we can revisit this at 2 o'clock, but we can put the headline on for the agenda. We don't disagree with the title of the ordinance. And
correct.
Working out the specificity on some of these elements, specifically the last paragraph, calling out the health and economic impact. I want to do like a cultural one in the wildlife.
I think wildlife is a very important thing to bring out, strictly because of the fact that that will include
tourism, travel to our area.
That'll be the economic, I think.
But I think specifically calling out that where we are normally hosting outside people
locals
were escaping.
But
I don't support anything that calls for the firing of anybody. I think that's their responsibility, not ours.
I don't really hold local people, I don't know enough to hold them responsible.
We're not headhunting here.
It's the policies that are wrong. Mm-hmm.
The policies need changed, and I think if we focus on that, it's a better message and a more powerful message. If with us asking for an outcome, we can actually defend.
Should we add up here in the title and say U.S. Forest Service Management Policies in the title?
I thought
I left that at all. Sure. Let me call you right back. Okay, sounds good. Bye.
So I read they had an officer-involved shooting yesterday.
That was Sheriff Daniels. He won't be able to make our meeting. So
which meeting?
Not on his plate this morning.
This meeting?
I think we're supposed to have a meeting with, not this one, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He had another meeting.
It might be in the matter of expressing no confidence in the U.S. Forest Service resource management policy. It's really a resource management plan, but I don't know.
Well, from my standpoint, I support the concept of what we're trying to do. I would be willing to support you two ironing out another draft for us that incorporates these ideas. Of that we're wanting a different plan or process put in there and these other elements we've talked about.
Great. Resource management plan and policy, maybe. Fire.
Title.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get there. Work on that. Thank you, Mr. Hicks.
Resource management plan and fire policy, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Fire needs to be in there. I think fire needs to be there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we'll, for the moment at least, continue targeting next Wednesday's business session.
Uh-huh.
For this, okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you at 2?
Well, yeah, we have the meeting with...
let's see if we can't get with Mark a little bit ahead of time.
Okay.
1:30 would be great.
Makes sense to me.
Out of strategy. Hey, how's it going? Mr. O'Hare?
Yep. Good. Very good.
Proposed fee changes.
Yes. I have no changes from what was submitted originally for Sheriff, Parks, and Public Works. I did add the community development pre-app fee, and that's what Julie was talking about last week when she brought it forward. I just have not had that in the packet. It'll be a separate order because of planning typically can be appealed. So we typically keep those two orders separate, everybody else in planning. So no changes, no comments, no feedback from
anyone.
So it's
Sheriff, Parks, and?
And Public Works.
Public Works? Okay.
Yes. Public Works had a, so let me just look. So Parks had some proposed fee changes that was in your packet last week, dealing with park fee, campsite fees. They're basically
wanted
to bring those in-house from Reserve America.
It was also the cemetery.
And
the
cemetery fees.
What do you guys want to do with the resale of a product? The order from 2005.
Yeah, I think
specifies product in it.
Right, and legal counsel
makes a recommendation.
And they're existing, so it's not as if we're changing by adding these. We're just simply continuing with what the practice has been. I think it's a great topic that should be considered, whether we need to do it or not. But
my opinion is no, and I don't like the order. It's an order, right?
Yes, what we're doing.
Yes. Knowing what other campgrounds and everything, if we're in the camping ground business, I think what it does is that camper and that thing, oh, I didn't know I could do firewood in a fire. Oh, well, here, you can buy some over here for this amount, or here, do this. It gives it a level of hospitality that essentially is what they're doing.
That's not the debate. It's to whether or not they should be included on a fee scrub. We are going to sell popsicles and firewood.
Yeah.
That's not the
debate. I do not think it should be on a fee schedule. I think that they should be able to cover their cost and whatever a little more administrative cost.
Nobody does. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to. You're refining the concept is you have an order that is approving the board to set fees. And it specifically calls for that it go through this process that not a lot of other people have to do on all products. And the question is do we have been advised by legal counsel that we need to include products on that? My opinion is who's going to challenge us to the state at the point that we're charging for firewood or popsicles and they're not delineated on our fee structure? Technically, we probably should by the outline of the order and what it says.
It's not just the order. It's also our charter as well as that ordinance that passed as far as getting fees from the parks.
Yeah.
It kind of falls
into
that.
All fees.
All fees, yeah. If it were straight reimbursement, it wouldn't
just
be.
Than just saying, oh, I don't think they should be included. You have to make a conscious decision that you're not necessarily feeling as though they are between the intent of what people said, oh, well, we don't want you to have planning fees that don't go through this process, that aren't able to be reviewed, Public Works, Sheriff's Office, other parks fees.
Why do we have...
Nobody else is running the cost of providing a resaled product.
But they say, or current retail cost. I mean, it's kind of one of those things that...
it's fairly discretionary. I mean, it moves. If popsicles,
yeah.
for some reason, there's a shortage of milk and they go through the roof, we're not going to give them away.
Right.
But it already says where retail cost, if retail cost is higher or lower or whatever. But what if it just said that? I mean, 10% above retail cost is what we're going to charge.
I think it could.
Is that include there in there? It's not a specific fee. It's just flat out whatever that day's retail cost was. It's 10% above to cover administrative.
We don't retail anything else, do we? I can't think of anything else we retail.
Are we going to, I don't know, I'll use White Horse Park for an example. You got a store right at the end of the lane going into White Horse Park that sells
everything.
All that stuff, yeah.
Twix bars and giant king cones and all of the other stuff. They sell all the other. All
we don't sell any of that at that park. We sell.
Why not?
Wood.
We sell wood, that's what
we don't have a store there.
Okay.
There isn't like
I just wonder from the competition side if
right. yeah, sure.
they're only 10% over cost, and here's that little store for a SpongeBob popsicle is $3, and we're selling for $1.90.
Yeah.
We get in trouble there.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't even know whether it's worth going down this road other than to just have a blanket statement about all things products that you sell. Because then you could have product. Other than that, you're going to have to go in and inventory everything that you do. In my business, it's how many drill screws did you use today? You know, and that you spend so much time on it that 10% isn't going to cover the time it takes to document all this stuff.
It would be probably advantageous for the board to pass an order for resale products are going to be at market rates.
Right.
They need to be at market rates. They should be over, but if they are, that helps the other guy.
Yeah.
We just can't have it there. They're at market rates. Basically, that's what we wanted.
Well, I want to cover our gas to go pick them up, you know, or the
time.
That's why I said 10% above retail, but or
it isn't 10% above retail.
No,
it's market rate because you can't charge for a resale item because our gas is subsidized. We're not paying road tax or blah, blah, blah. And so we can sell it cheaper than the next guy. No, you don't get to sell it cheaper than the next guy. You can't undermine the private sector. So it has to be at market rates. I think we could do an order with this fee schedule that says those are the rules for resale items.
And that way, this list becomes flexible. If Sarah sees something she needs to add to this list, it's not a big deal to
her. Yeah, I wouldn't like to. I don't like the.
I don't either. What I'm hoping for is that we don't vacillate as a board, not you. It's the next board that comes in and says, why aren't we abiding by that order in 2005 that says we're going to codify all products?
We need to do an order.
But if we do an order, it says this is why. Because you can't deviate from market rate. That's what it needs to be.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe that's what we work on. We remove products, we do an order, and that satisfies, and then we just look at fees.
And then it gives some flexibility to the parks director to see what, because giant Neapolitan sandwiches may not be the hit in 2 years or even available for that matter.
Right. Because ORS has specified that fees for service have to be a direct reflection of cost. But there isn't a direct reflection of cost associated with resale of products. You paid X, and maybe we buy bulk off of GSA, and we get 5,000 popsicles. That guy didn't get that deal, so we shouldn't. Anyway, that's a dumb argument. But
just and I think that keeps us out of hot water with any retailers that are around there.
It does, and I think it gives them something to hold up and say, hey, you can't be selling those things for a buck less than I am.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'll do, I think we'll still we'll keep the front page that has the other park fees, the tent camping and the Granite Hill.
Yeah, just remove
and just remove the second page.
We're not in competition with anybody on the tents and the camp spaces or anything, but we are on the property.
Well, we are.
Yeah.
There are private RV parks.
KOAs,
and Sarah does a review of what Jackson County is charging, what Douglas County is charging, what other private sectors are charging, and we really shouldn't be undermining them either. So we can charge in excess. We just shouldn't charge less.
Okay.
It's good.
So then we'll move forward on that one. The Public Works, of course, there's no new fees. We're just changing the existing fees.
I'm not sure about the pre-app fee of $500. I just feel like it feels like she's a new everybody. I've had four planning directors, and they go, you know, these extremes. It was $350 or $375 before. We went to zero. That didn't work. So sure, I thought it would, and then now we're going to $500. Probably find ourselves visiting this issue next year and saying, well, 500 has been a deterrent for people to come in and do a pre-application on projects, and we're just getting, you know, there's going to be, people need to have a reasonable opportunity to go through a pre-application phase, and maybe it goes through that phase, and they never end up doing that thing, but why would they spend $500 to do it? I think a $250, $300 is a very reasonable place to sit down and have a conversation, a real conversation about maybe a project that may or may not happen. 500 gives the expectation that they're 99% done and that the application fee is going to be discounted by $500 when I know that isn't the case a lot of times. So
I don't mind 300. What did you say? It was 350 before?
It was 375 if I remember correctly.
375 and we felt we removed it because we thought it was getting in the way of. So don't go back to above 375. That is even more of a hindrance.
Well, she was doing that with the idea that it would count against the application. Mm-hmm. It's a credit. I don't mind the idea of a credit, but it shouldn't be a deterrent. $500, I'm not paying that to come in and have a conversation about something I'm pretty sure I want to do, but I'm not.
And is there something they get with a pre-app? I mean, if you say, yeah, your pre-app is $300 and this is what it covers?
The intent of a pre-app back when Harold Haugen instituted in late 90s.
It was answering all questions.
It was answering questions. Mm-hmm. There was a, you should get, but now they're treating the pre-application like an application. And that's not what its intent was.
No. But there should be something, you know, and here again, I go back to my experience across the parking lot, that the person's paying the $300 needs to have a reasonable expectation of what that means. So we go through that pre-app, and then all of a sudden when I come in to get my app, and it hasn't changed from the pre-app, then, oh, by the way, we need you to put sidewalks. Oh, by the way, you have to pave your driveway with 4-inch thick asphalt instead of what you thought was 2. Oh, by the way, there should be something at the pre-app site that says this is exactly what you're going to get for that $300 and how long it, you know.
But that would be the app.
That's technically the app.
Yeah.
And there should be something on there that says, you know, this is not, you know, the app is where we will make all that determination.
I don't like the oh, by the ways.
I don't know.
These are the professionals. They're supposed to tell you comprehensively.
Exactly. And if you put that, oh, by the way, on there, because we did it over there, you know, if you miss something.
The program eats it.
You're the professional.
Yeah.
Sorry, you had your opportunity to tell us what it was going to be, and you missed. So it's not another $500.
It wasn't.
$200.
But that sounds good to me. I was thinking back to what the director said last week is that the pre-app is just to get people from out in left field to bring them, you know, back.
Give them an idea what the application
right,
should be.
Right, and what the steps are that they need to follow and who
no
they
problem.
Need to
That's
touch bases with. And then the offset is that it would reduce your app, that if you did actually then move forward with your project, that $500, $300, or $250, whatever,
would
be applied towards your full app fee.
She says she's spending too much time answering questions that don't result in an application. And that's kind of what I said was going to happen when you don't charge anything mm-hmm. for a pre-application fee. Mm-hmm. You need to have some skin in the game when people are going to sit down and talk about a project.
Well, I'm in favor of $300 and it applies to the permit or you lose it. If you don't ever exercise a permit and actually fill out an application, you lose your $300 at the pre-app site.
I'm not opposed to going forward with the $500, but I think mm-hmm. we're going to hear from a lot of people that say that's outrageous to mm-hmm. start with a conversation about a project that I'm thinking about doing.
Well, if it was $375 before and we thought it was outrageous and so we're going to take it all the way down to zero, I would say let's not go back up to $375 or to $500. I'd say go to $300,
I think
which
your proposal
is a little more affordable.
It's very reasonable.
I think you would get more takers at $300 than you would $375 and $500.
And
you're
it
right
still would apply towards the application? Mm-hmm. I support that. I would support
and
$300.
And if they don't, they lose the $300. It's a deposit.
Yeah.
It's basically
so
down.
It sounds like three is not too onerous as far as inhibiting people.
The other nexus to look at when you're arriving at a pre-application is how much time and energy is a pre-application costing staff. Mm-hmm. If a pre-application is a one-hour consultation, it doesn't need to be $300 to rely on that. The staff's cost, what is it? It's $75, $100 an hour, you know, whatever. Then that's what you should evaluate. No, actually, all of these the average pre-application takes at least a two-hour conversation about your proposal. Well, then you're at $200 or what have you. Well, we have two people in the room.
But
we have a senior planner and a code enforcement. Well, then you're back up to $300. But that's the argument that I want to, that's the discussion that I want to have. It says, how did you arrive at $300 or $500?
I think $300 is very justifiable, you know.
It sounds reasonable.
And some of them are going to take 2 hours and some of them are going to take 6 hours.
Yeah.
So you just kind of hit somewhere
the
in between
spot.
That, and if it's $100 an hour, $300 hits the mark. But I see value in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I was coming in and saying, you know, what do I need to do, and I'm willing to pay $300 to get your expertise, how much time of my contractor, now that my contractor knows what to provide for that permit, I'm going to save money on my contract.
That's a really good point about going out to the private sector and hiring a consultant. It's going to cost you $300 to sit down and have this conversation about what it is that you want to do, and you don't have to go to planning. I'll answer all those questions. I know exactly what the RLDC calls for. Don't worry about it. You can talk to me. There you go.
I don't have a problem with the $300.
I think that makes sense.
And I think the application side, to apply it to an actual permit.
Do we change this now, or do we change this? I mean, she's not in the room to change.
Right.
To
well, what I would do is right now is, after this meeting, is I would call her or talk to her and say, this is the discussion. Are you fine with that? Do we want to move it forward? Because all we're doing right now is just moving this packet forward to the weekly business session to set a public hearing. So we can change these now have them codified.
I would rather change it now because we don't hear from people as a result of making this decision today of moving it to 3 for the hearing. Mm-hmm. That's great. I would rather not have to hear from people.
Well, next Wednesday we'll set the hearing date, and the packet in next Wednesday's business session will include the changed price.
Okay, call her up and
make sure you explain to her what our conversation was here.
Right.
She understands the reasoning behind it.
Okay. Very good. Officially, that's all I had. There were a couple of FYI things, but do you want to take the time for that?
Oh, by the ways.
Yeah. Oh, by the ways. By the way.
So, Arthur, have we ever had the discussion about Douglas County,
mm-hmm.
they don't facilitate building and self-safety inspections administration.
They have the state do that.
The state's doing it.
Yeah.
I'd like to look at the positives and negatives about that program.
Okay.
I hear way too many things in my conversations out there. My evening was ruined last night by the stories I hear, by not local contractors, just layman people building homes, doing developments, and it doesn't come back to planning, it comes back to building and safety. And it's too many times the most quality people that I know and revere in our community are having these challenges with that program. And when I address it, they're very eager to come in and provide a justification. There is no justification. You left a bad taste in the mouth of people I couldn't revere any higher, and that's unacceptable. They're the best people we have in this community having the worst experience with your program. It's unacceptable. That cannot happen. And I don't want to do it anymore. So I'm not looking at it from a vindictive standpoint. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong, and I'm not able to change it. What does it look like if the state runs this program?
And they do in many, many locales. You've mentioned Douglas, but many, many of the eastern Oregon counties in particular, they let the state run the program. In coastal counties too. I remember we went to Coquille. They have a substation, Coquille, and Astoria State, mm-hmm. a state building codes department in Coquille and Astoria, Pendleton.
Yeah.
So
it comes back to those are the good people wanting to do the right thing, and they're getting it. It's challenging for them. So they have a conversation with everybody they know. And so 50% of the people that they have that conversation with say, well, I'm not going to go get a building permit from planning, building safety. I'm just not going to do it. You know, what are the ramifications? There really are none, you know?
I think it's a good conversation. And although our community development director, one of the reasons we brought
her
very
in.
Busy with the
marijuana.
Cannabis issue. But one of the reasons we brought that in and made that department the way it is to address that customer service angle. I think, it'd be good to have a conversation with her and see what plans she might have in the future for that program.
Well, let's discuss that.
I'll follow up with her on that. I did want to mention that our first biweekly payroll is next Tuesday. So all employees will be getting a check next Tuesday for the work they've done from October 1st through October 14th. So we'll expect to hear quite a few people saying, why am I getting a check? I did not sign up for a draw.
We discussed this yesterday,
yeah.
and it's an issue for some people, it's not an issue for others. It just, we have to go back to why we're doing this, because half of our staff are doing mid-month draws. It's a very cumbersome system for finance. It's supposed to make it easier. I don't want anybody to get the expectation, but I know that Arthur is working towards a more timely reflection of the work already incurred. So if you've got 2 weeks done in the month, getting it done, you know, Friday, and you're going to get paid on the next Friday or something to that effect. Yeah. And it's just working out the internal practices with getting those, you know, in a timely fashion. It starts out with the managers and the employee doing their time on time.
Accurately,
we've got some people doing stuff, working on Saturdays, working on Sundays, that they don't get the time to do the payroll stuff until the next Monday, which means then they got to get it all through finance and their system. Then they got to get to the bank, and that takes a couple of days. So shaving off a little bit of time on everything gets it done on a Friday, and you get paid on a Friday. But right now, I think he's really done the right thing of saying, we know we can get it done by next Tuesday. Could we do it by Monday or the previous Friday? Maybe. But
so
let's not overpromise and underdeliver.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
One question is there still just one department not using time clock?
No, all departments are using time clock. I think the question really boils down to how efficiently are they using the time clock. You know, are they superimposing that on top of an existing system? They haven't updated their system, you know, internally to take full advantage of the technology that we're providing.
So the sheriff's office is now using time clock.
I believe the correction deputies are using time clock, those at the jail. Patrol, not so certain.
Okay.
That could still be that the supervisors are inputting their time and not the employee themselves. So, you know, everybody's using time clock. All time is being reported through the time clock.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was concerned that you're getting two different systems, which also would add to your time.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Everything's going through time clock. The sheriff, I was over at the jail a couple weeks ago, and the nice signs right on the locker room doors as you're coming, going both sides, going into the jail, remember to clock in, clock out. So he's making an effort, concerted effort, to get all his employees to utilize that. My personal feeling is, why wouldn't you? If I am given the opportunity to make sure that all my time is being recorded accurately, on time, exactly what I'm doing, coming in, coming out, and you're giving me that opportunity to ensure that happens, yeah, I like it. I want to do that. As an employee, that way I'm sure that it's getting recorded properly, and I don't have to worry whether something gets lost in the translation or whether somebody overlooks my overtime.
How many employees do we have? You know, so this morning I'm getting ready, putting on my tie, and Tim Freeman, commissioner from Douglas County, calls. I'm not on the clock yet, you know, I'm not technically working, but I answer his phone call.
Sure.
And 24 minutes later, it makes me late into the office, but I didn't get a count for that time.
Right.
I'm a salaried employee, it doesn't really matter. And that happens
right.
Every day, you know, up until the evening. I'll wake up in the middle of the night and somebody was like, I did not expect you to respond at 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm. I was up, you emailed, why not, and stuff. So, but how many employees do we have that are working like that are not salaried, that are hourly? Not very many.
It's hard to say, because if you're being paid 8 to 5, you're an hourly employee, and whatever your time schedule is, but 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, then typically you would not answer that phone at 10 till 8 if you happen to be there, you know,
unless
a little bit early.
Emergency.
Well, unless you can see.
I'll give you a countering opinion. I received an email from Peggy Anderson at the fairgrounds regarding an animal control issue at 7:07 p.m. last night. Animal control officer responded at 7:19 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
not on duty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she got compensated for that time. Now, it is something at Community Corrections. Every PO is on call every night. They have it worked into their contract how mm-hmm. that compensation works. And I assume animal control officers have worked in their contract. If not, it needs to be something they negotiate on
sure.
how they're compensated for that time. But just last night, I had an employee send me an email at 7:19.
And you've got employees in that specific, and that's part of their job. Not going to happen with...
And you sent one at 10 p.m., and JJ sent one at 9 p.m.
Yeah, those are salaried. I'm not worried so much
about
people.
But, you know, Deanna in AP She's not going to be called at 7 p.m. Animal control is, and they are compensated for that when they clock in the next day, or if they need to make a, they can do it on their cell phone, their smartphone, or when they get into the, they can punch the clock and say, I worked from this to this. Yes, sir.
From an employer standpoint, because we are the employer, if you don't clock in and you get hurt, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So if you're an employee who says, well, I didn't have time to clock in, or consistently misses it, you're putting the employer or the employer at risk, because you're not demanding. This is the way it is. This is our policy. You punch in. You give them, like, your animal control office. Do they have a deal that they can punch in on their phone and say, it starts the clock. This is when I had to respond. This is when I got home again, 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
If that isn't documented somewhere, if she were to get hurt, bit by a horse, kicked by a horse, whatever, she essentially is not on the clock. She's not on the clock. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
She was volunteering her time all of a sudden.
And
that's the main thing with the clock.
I think
you're just saying, is there a process to make sure she gets compensated for what she's doing after hours? And I think
that's
very important that they do that. If they don't, well, we're out there a mile. They're out there a mile. They can, I've had people, I was working. I said, it sure doesn't show that on the ticket.
And I would say the same thing on your progress or your program reports. When you report back, what have you done on your program? If you don't fill out that report and say, this is what I've done, then who knows what's happened. So time clock, in my sense, in my view, is the same as a progress report or a program report. You're recording your time on this one, you're recording your actions and your program results on that one. But both of them together work to say, this is what I've been doing.
There is a phone app for time clock for employees that work after hours or random times.
That's true.
The deputies technically can sign in on their cell phone in the patrol car.
Right.
They get in, they sign in, they grab the radio and say, I'm in service. It's already done. What we found is that because of the networks in our area, there's some areas that have cell phone coverage, some areas do not.
Depending where you're at.
And that can affect that.
But usually their time doesn't start the second they get in the car.
It does.
I mean, it doesn't, they don't go to the locker room, they don't check in.
No, the deputies actually get dressed at
patrol.
Patrol deputies.
Yeah. But see, so here's what I've been thinking, although I haven't talked to the sheriff about this specifically, but what about if dispatch, okay, there's the flaw in the program, but what about if we have dispatch log them in? Deputy calls in, say, I'm in my car, I'm heading out, dispatch gets the call, they know it, they log them in at that point. Now you're on the clock.
The only issue with that is that if they're also handling a 911 call that's been transferred to them and they have two more on hold or something else like that, then they have to go back and...
Dispatch, that's the...
How often does that happen? I was listening a little bit to dispatch, and it sounds as though they could just write that down. They have to reiterate, what they heard and stuff, and, they just... They got to...
Yeah.
And then when they get those two calls done and they get a minute...
I don't know how practical
so
that would
be. So time clock, though, logs in the time
as it is.
You're taking the employee out of it. It's when the employee checked in, not when the girl in dispatch said, the guy says, I was there at 8 o'clock, and I called that in, that I'm in service.
Yeah. Right.
You have me down for 8:20, because that's when you got around to it.
Yes.
I just lost 20 minutes because of you. I want that control.
And that's why we have the app on the phone,
that they
control. It's my employee number, log in.
And theoretically, when they get back into the service area, that phone holds that information. The app holds the information and then connects with the network. So, there's some...
So it sounds like it could work.
It could work, but it depends. I mean, if you're stationed out in IV...
I think the key is the employee needs to know that it's their responsibility to work that time clock.
Yeah.
Not yours, not mine. If they want to get paid, they better punch in and they better punch out.
But we also need to talk about, for us, when we have a central support system as a county, we as the county administrators, if we have elected officials who say, I'm not going to make my employees use your system, what do we do then? Because that's what's happened.
But we...
You have to be... That's your key. You want to get paid?
We're working with those folks.
Yeah,
I don't think we have any...
9% of the way there.
Yeah, I think so. I think
you've made progress since it first started, too.
Yes.
I don't think it's as hard as people thought it might have been.
No.
And it's just changed. People
it's
don't...
It's just a change. Just
it is. It is changed.
They're used to getting this amount of money once a month. When they get half of that twice a month, the psychologists are like, well, they cut my pay in half. No, you get two paydays.
Yeah.
You know, it's just psychological.
I can tell you, though, from my standpoint as a supervisor, when it was initiated, I hated the program.
Yeah.
It was more time and effort than ever should have been made. But we learned that there was some faulty equipment at Community Corrections that was leading to some of the issues that were creating more work for the supervisors. So once those bugs were worked out, I've heard they don't hate it as much now that I'm gone.
Yeah. It's... The hate has gone smoother.
The hate, yeah.
So,
put the hate thing down in there.
So first biweekly is next week. And then, of course, it's every 2 weeks. After every second Tuesday, you'll be getting a paycheck after that. And so far, everything looks great. It's actually working as smooth as we had hoped it would work as far as the internal process that we're doing. So audits, so we got the auditors here. They're here this week. They're here next week. And... all things being equal, we should have our financials out, hopefully by the first part of December.
Did they already do those interviews with electeds? I don't remember.
I don't think they have, and I'm not sure whether... Now, typically they do a what's called the fraud interview. You know, are you aware of anything? Have you seen it? Are there any concerns? You know, that kind of a interview. And I haven't heard them where they've scheduled that. So I don't know if that's part of this cycle or whether they feel they're going to do other things. They're new auditors, Moss Adams. This is their first audit of Josephine County, and so they're looking at things and documenting things that haven't been looked at perhaps or documented.
New auditors to us.
New auditors
not
to us.
Not new auditors.
No, correct. Yeah, Moss Adams has been around for a long time. They're a good, great company.
Well, I'll go down. I usually do when they're here and just make an introduction.
That'd be good.
Stuff.
That would be good.
I liked Eisler, and they seemed great.
Yeah, it was just time. I mean, it's good to rotate.
Yeah.
To get different
set
of
eyes. We tried a couple of years ago, and that didn't work out. So.
Well, that was,
yeah.
Hugo, I did get an email back where the gal who said, you know, they're wanting their reimbursement of the awards to try to set up a meeting with Commissioner Hare and myself and the folks from the Mental Health Division of the State of Oregon that want $73,000 back from because we didn't use Hugo Hills for 30 years. She said, we've been through this before with other agencies, and they have to pay it back. It's just part of the contract. So I just wanted to let you know that's her position at this point in time, but we're going to set up a meeting to discuss.
What are the ramifications if we choose not to?
That may be a good question during our discussion. I don't know what they're... They might put a lien on it, as far as I know.
Well, we can go to court and challenge the lien. I mean, I don't know. It just
won't be straightened out of sale anyway, won't it, if they lien it?
Yeah, and then the sale proceeds. They would get their cut.
Or you can download... We'll split it with you right now, and you get a check this afternoon. Or you can lien it. You can lien it when it sells.
Or they point back to that contract that was signed by the three commissioners in 1995 that says, if I don't use it for 30 years, we will pay it back.
It's fraudulent. They were signing it under duress. Whatever. They were, you know.
So the next
not acting
FYI.
On behalf of the county in good stead. I mean, there's a ton of legal arguments you can make about why a 30-year... simple amortization depreciation on a remodel investment doesn't make fiscal sense or reasonable to me.
Yeah, all those improvements have been depreciated.
It's the perpetual. It's the company store. I mean, they don't last, and I have to go out and get another $200,000 grant to do a remodel on the remodel we did 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Just tack that 5 years onto the end. Couple series is I'm at 40, 50 years of depreciation. I'm never going to get there.
Right. You never will.
It's like putting your appliances on a home mortgage of 30 years. You've replaced them twice.
Yeah.
You're still paying on the appliances that you
bought the first time.
And the expectation that the state of Oregon never expected to get that money back.
No.
That was never part of their expectation or deal. They're not counting on it. They're not using it.
It's not a revolving
loan. Yes. Revolving loans. So it just seems like it's excessive. The other thing I wanted to bring up was that Mike MacArthur, Executive Director of Association of Oregon Counties,
sent out an email wondering if to all counties, wondering if they wanted to, if the county would like to participate in a review of the PERS side accounts, which Econ Northwest is doing this on behalf of the Oregon School Board Association for all the different school districts. And so Mike was wondering whether the counties would be interested in participating in that review. Basically, what they're talking about, the schools are getting slammed with PERS increases, you know, 5, 6, 8% every biennium increase. And a side account is where you can put a chunk of money into PERS, and it will reduce that increase. They'll apply that account, so you can give them.
I thought they had this PERS thing fixed to where it wasn't going to go on and continue through the roof.
And you're the only person in the state that feels that the PERS system is fixed.
I don't think.
The new PERS people aren't getting anything with what the old PERS people did.
Well, guess what? I'm not hearing that.
There's still a lot of old people.
There's still
a lot. Not me. I'm not you. By the way,
those tier one people are.
I'm an elected official. I can opt in or out, and I opted out.
And
I don't want to be part of that.
We only have one person.
I was not given the option to opt out.
What's happened?
In effect, what is going on is there's a fixed.
But
cost
I'm not tier two.
That is sitting out there for existing employees and existing costs under the old plans. It's a fixed cost that they have to allocate over the current workforce. And so you can shrink the workforce. That does not shrink the fixed cost. It just means you're allocating a larger portion to each individual. And so that's where what we're dealing with really on PERS. The ongoing cost for current new employees is not what's breaking the bank. It's the old folks with fixed cost they have to amortize.
We did talk yesterday about looking at a potential for Josephine County to transition to a different kind of system time. And I think that running a pilot opportunity is with the area that we have the discretion over, which is elected officials, might be a great place to start, and then showcasing that to non-unions, places we can maybe dip our toe into the pool, and eventually finding ourselves weaning out of that system. Yeah. We were late into the PERS system, and so we don't have the iceberg of that is big with the tier ones out there. There are some, but I think we've done. Yeah. Arthur and his predecessor did a pretty good job of bonding out that long term liability. So it isn't the same percentage of our payroll that you're seeing at the schools.
Right.
You know, they're grabbing 25. You were saying a
35%
of their cost associated with
payroll.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh no, I got this. There's some cities, little towns in eastern Oregon that 50%. PERS is 50% of their payroll cost. So
online education is right around the corner where you don't have a teacher. You have a screen in the room.
Yep.
And one teacher's teaching 7,000 kids.
Yep.
Done deal. We can't afford teachers anymore. Take your lunch pail and go home.
Yeah.
Not interested any longer.
Well, I think
then you can take the good teacher on that screen, and the bad teachers, they're all gone.
And that's coming down the pike. But I think what Commissioner Hare was mentioning is something that I've talked to Wally about. I've talked to PERS, the executive director. I've talked to some of our legislators, is to give an alternative to PERS, give counties and cities an alternative to PERS, so that it's not like, you know, the mafia, once you're in, that you can't get out. And that's kind of where we're at now. Once you're in, you can't get out. I think
there
our
are,
younger workforce.
There are companies, I mean, there are programs in the state that are able to.
Oregon University System has negotiated to where their employees have the choice. You can go to PERS, or you can go to our deferred comp program, a matching deferred comp. And that was approved by the Oregon legislature that they can do that, the Oregon university system.
Where in the world did it ever go? You know, it just boggles my mind that judges are all on PERS. So if you go appeal to a judge on anything related to Perth, he sits right there and violates his oath by not recusing himself.
It used to be where both legislators and judges were not part of PERS when it was originally started. When it originally started, mm-hmm. they were not, for that very reason, the conflict of interest issue. But that
went by the wayside.
Over time in the 70s.
We're very careful about conflict. I've heard Commissioner Morgan, now I might have a conflict.
Yeah.
Heard Commissioner Harris say it. I don't have a conflict with anybody.
I think it would be a legal opinion. For everybody.
Yeah. It'd be just crazy, though, how it can happen.
I think
why
has
the state been sued? Why has the PERD been sued by somebody?
Wally, JJ, and Arthur could probably. I think we should talk about it and really, you know, get this board's understanding.
Where we go?
Where we're
we
at.
We feel anything. We can't. There's no place
well,
to go.
Well, I think
not
we exactly
need to offer the
issue that we have to figure out what we can do within
right.
the parameters of that we have. And frankly, it's really nice that we don't have that small town liability because we were late to the party, the tier ones, and we've done a good job of keeping our costs reasonable.
Our increase was 3.8% this last biennium, you know, compared to some of the other municipalities that were looking at 8% or more. So I think we're in good shape.
Just a second. Hey.
The other thing, though,
he said wait.
He did.
So let's pause.
Well, he doesn't need to hear any
No,
of this.
Let's wait.
He doesn't know.
Gonna come back with what he does.
Hope not.
Yeah, was he gonna fight something? No, everything's fine. Everything's fine. It's all good.
So now, when the earthquake happened in Miami, I was watching Monday night football, and the our house was going like this.
Mm. Isn't that weird, that rolling feeling?
It is.
Yeah.
And it sounded like a freight train.
I was on the top floor of a dormitory in Seattle when a rolling earthquake came in.
Wow. So there was
we waited for you.
Thank you. There was conversations yesterday about citizen initiative to curb cannabis production on RR, but it hasn't been defined yet. And our esteemed appointed clerk was given explicit instructions that when that happens, the board needs to be notified of the language so that we know what the bookends are. You know, we've got the non-binding question. We've got the legal parameters of marijuana production and it's granted by the state. We've missed the window of 5%. You will be able to produce marijuana in Josephine County, but if there's a citizen initiative out there, I want to know before we're scheduling our first reading and what does it look like. So she was out yesterday. And they've just started the conversations. I was told that they had dropped off the final, this is what we're referring to the voters, we're going to collect signatures on. That's not the case.
I would like to have a conversation with whoever is doing that.
Well, I can get you their name. I don't think it's public yet. But
I would love to do that.
What was I going to say? Shoot. Oh, they wanted to do it on the January, but Secretary of State Richardson sent out an email this last week that said, you're not putting anything else on the January ballot. It is just this one statewide issue. No local referendums will be included on that.
Interesting.
Yes, it is.
That's a good idea, to be honest with you.
Well, from a cost standpoint, they've agreed to pick up the cost of that election, which is not cheap.
No.
And anybody else who wanted to be on it, this clerk, segregates out those costs. So if we wanted to ask a non-binding question, you know, it isn't always $1,200. It depends on how many other players are part of that. So, anyway.
So my recommendation as far as our participation in this study that Econ Northwest is doing would be no. I'm not, from my personal point of view, I don't think Josephine County can benefit from any study as far as what the site account benefits might come to us.
Their value is in the people that are 8 to 10% or 7%. They're not in. Our value is at 3% or 2.5% of where it said it was.
Right. Yeah. That's just the increase. We're paying more than that.
Right.
I mean, we're.
And their report would tell us to do what we're doing, what we've done.
Yeah, what we've already done. And I don't. I mean, our only option would be to throw a ton of cash
at PERS, you know, $10 million or something, and I would not recommend bonding out $10 million to stick into the PERS account.
Well, not in the trajectory of level of staff that we're doing. 20% increase in community corrections, those people are paying against our unfunded, our bonded liability for PERS, and distributing that over more people is the way the system is supposed to work. Now, we went from 660 employees, 450 when I took office, down to 280, 300. Yeah. Now we're at 350, you know. And it doesn't take any more local tax money. It's really state-funded programs that are paying for that local liability. So.
Well, I have reservation about going out there and getting a big bond to say, okay, we're putting this in it, because a lot of times when you go in a negotiation with anybody, they go, you have the ability to repay because I know you got $10 million set aside.
The other thing is Eco Northwest is not a company that I'm endorsing AOC to be in partnership with, and I made that pretty clear to Craig Pope, our incoming president, yesterday in a good short conversation, and he understood where I was coming from, and he's going to make that note to our executive director. There's some challenges at AOC that's going on right now, and we don't need to be caught up in more stuff.
I would like to, I stayed for the board meeting at our AOC meeting last week, and the budget came up. There's a recommendation of some increases to dues, and both a 4% increase above a normal increase, so it would be a total of a 7% increase on the general dues, and then on veterans and some other ones. So there was going to be a task force created to kind of address and come back with some recommendations. So just wanted to give you a heads up that they...
I think I'm chairing that task force.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So I'm on the budget committee. I'm not sure that we made the recommendation for... I know.
They created a subcommittee in that board meeting, and...
it was my recommendation to do so. So, yeah, I think I'm chairing that. And in partnership with... no, it isn't the treasurer. Rod Runyon is not doing
that. No, it was the first vice chair, Pope, was at least the board meeting portion that they had talked about. The recommendations were made, and then in that they created a subcommittee in that board meeting. I'm not sure where it's at as far as what will be coming to us.
What we're looking to try to do is evaluate the dues structure. There are some counties that are paying virtually nothing and benefiting a lot by a veterans program or public works service. And we've changed that formula of the state for transportation distribution to small counties to where they actually get something out of a transportation package. But at the same time, I'm asking the question of what are we getting for the association we're paying for now, and what would it cost me to get the association I want? We're paying $28,000, roughly thereabouts. I would pay double that for an association that carries our issues and gets something done in Salem with these four issues. I would advocate for spending $60,000 a year, because the substitute is we go out and we try to find a part-time lobbyist to go on behalf of Josephine County. Who? Nobody cares. They don't. So you have to be part of this thing. But right now, we're nickeling and diming ourselves, getting nowhere. I'd rather say, what does it take to get those land use issues of housing addressed and other issues that I think we've got that really pertain to these people out here who are saying, I can't find a place to live, I can't find the job, I can't do this, I can't do that. Let's get the districts paying for tax and assessment. Let's just solve that issue. Give us the discretion to charge our districts those kinds of things and stop dinking around, getting nowhere.
Well, and look at Jackson County. They did not feel that AOC was actually supporting ONC lands and natural resource lands appropriately. And that's primarily why they say they pull out, is they didn't get the representation that they wanted and are trying to advocate for others to challenge AOC's stance on those issues. You just mentioned housing, so remind me to bring up a topic when we come up with other items.
One final FYI, by the way, OVUTS, is that from the assessor just certified the tax roll, and I just wanted to let you know that $42,000 is going to the Urban Renewal Agency from Josephine County taxes. So what we would normally have collected this coming year as part of our 58 cents or part of our 93 cent or 8 cent.
How much?
$42,000. That's the first year. This is the first year that's in existence. As time goes on, I believe our last urban renewal in the final year of its existence was taking a little over $200,000.
Yeah, they start out small, but as development within the urban renewal area goes up, it becomes about year 7 or 8, it becomes a real cash cow.
Yeah, so that's $200,000 that would have been deposited to the general fund that instead is going to the urban renewal.
We need to keep track.
That was last year. This year, just $42,000.
We need to kind of keep a running tally on that because our fairgrounds is right smack in the middle of their urban renewal. And when they say, oh, no, we're just not interested in doing anything out there, just say, whoa, wait 1 second. We have contributed, and we'd like to get every bit of that and more back because it's advantage to the city and to have our fairgrounds looking better or developed into something that would fit in your plan.
And that's on our website, and it's part of the assessor's tax certification brochure.
She also did an updated breakdown and sent me the spreadsheet of a spreadsheet I asked for the distribution of properties by zone. And I don't know if you got. I think she just sent it to me, but I can send it to everybody. It's really interesting to see how many. It's about 200,000 acres of 2.5 zone, something. You know, it's got it all broken down to how much is available in each of those zones. So.
Hmm.
It's really helpful.
Wide zone.
Yep, countywide.
Anything else?
I asked the office to do some research. I know you guys are probably more solid in your positions on construction excise tax than I am. No, I'm very solid in my position on construction excise tax. I should rephrase that. So we were presented with by the school districts that we were kind of a laggard as far as setting our rates and keeping up with the percentage of increase based on the CPI or something inflation or whatever. So we've called around, and we haven't called to all of them yet. We don't have everything, but I did some asking at some of the meetings that I've been to recently in the last week or so. So I believe Klamath doesn't collect one, but we don't have that confirmed. I know that Coos and Douglas do not collect a construction excise tax. We're still working on Curry. Jackson does on residential. It's about $1.26 a square foot. Don't know if they do it on commercial. I feel as though I was misled from the standpoint that every other county around us can collect one, and it's higher. That's not what we're finding out. So we still have some research to do on that, but... I would imagine that it's because it's a discretionary thing. Even if ORS says we're going to collect it, you have to sign an IGA. And if those counties choose not to sign an IGA, take us to court and make us do something that's an unfunded mandate. I just feel it's not an unfunded mandate because we're able to appreciate a cost of administration for collecting it. It's just something that I feel is discretionary, and I don't feel it benefits the community. The nice timing of this is that you can say, we got $206,000 of unbudgeted marijuana revenue. It isn't in our budget. We had no idea how much it was going to be or even when it was going to come in. Good management, fiscal management would have been the same thing for them. It's not in their budget. But I would imagine they got at least what we got. Their percentage is double.
They get 40%. The school districts get 40% of the marijuana money.
We're getting 10.
And the counties get 10.
So I would imagine they're just appreciating at least $800,000 revenue stream they didn't necessarily anticipate.
What I've heard is the local amount that potentially is coming is less than $50,000, at least to Three Rivers School District.
How is
because
that possible?
It's based on attendance. So just as if they basically looked at their distribution for other things statewide with education departments. So, yes, 40% went to education statewide, but the Department of Education is distributing to the communities.
On a different formula.
And Three Rivers School District is anticipating they will get less than $50,000.
Wow.
I still have principle. You administer a program and you collect appreciation on your asset, and that's how you fund your... deal. I totally get their fiscal challenges, but it didn't feel like a cooperative measure, and I totally bear the responsibility of coming on the first meeting with Mr. Valenzuela and saying, we're not inclined to renew this IGA with you. My fault. But at the same time, they had a board meeting, didn't notice us, of discussing renewing the IGA and increasing their construction excise tax, and then presented maybe false information at a meeting.
Is there anything stopping them from collecting their own excise tax?
They wouldn't have a nexus to do it. It's when the building permit is issued.
It has to be done through the county.
I guess.
So there's options.
Yeah, there should be. No. I'd like to negotiate it. Maybe we sit down and talk about it, and I think we need to have true information based on our comparative counties, which are the region, and say, look, guys, nobody else is doing this except for Jackson County because they can afford to do it. We have to look at other alternatives for funding this. And let us help you. Sure, happy to do it. But I can't see charging the commercial one. For me, is the big one. It's a job that brings a family, that puts a kid in school. And if the job never happens, the kid isn't in school. We need to do everything we do focused on getting more jobs, bringing more families, putting more kids in school, and then there's not deterring that. I know that Kirk Kraus had a second thought when he looked at that construction excise bill of $30,000, and you can just imagine if the residential development applications, when Julie was in here, was basically like 9, not a whole lot of stuff going on. Where is that $350,000 coming from? It's coming out of the commercial sector. And what are those companies doing when they look at Douglas County and they're not collecting a construction excise tax, or Coos County, right on the port of Coos Bay?
The businessman looks at it as, what did buy $30,000 or $300,000 or $100,000, whatever it is, what does that buy me? If it's tacked on the price of my home, that was... You just took all of my appliances, my whole appliance budget, and sent it in for what? I don't even have kids in school.
Well, if it was $200,000, say, from the commercial side, that's 400,000 square feet of construction that happened. How much, as a percentage, didn't happen maybe because of that? I don't know. Or maybe it's a drop in the bucket. We talked to a couple of guys. It just doesn't feel like it is because we get the calls. I get the calls. I've gotten calls from a lot of people who are doing, and they get to the building and safety department, and they say, what is this? Why am I having to pay it? And I don't know. Goes to school.
And here again, though, that's how that always works out. The county ends up being
Curry,
the bad guy.
Curry hadn't heard of it. Never heard of it. Coos, no tax. Douglas, no tax. Jackson is a $1.26 residential. And we're waiting to hear back. Twice called to Klamath. But I talked to the Klamath. I talked to all three of the Klamath County Commissioners, and they'd never heard of it either. So.
Whoops.
Okay. We'll readdress this one. I just wanted you to be aware that I'm looking into this. I don't know if it changes your guys' opinion, but I think it reinforces mine.
I think that there needs to be further conversations, especially with getting the information, the backup, background information.
Bring back in the room.
Well, I don't know if it's the superintendents that are the appropriate ones for that conversation or the boards as the elected bodies.
They're setting the rate. The superintendents are making a recommendation. I'm sure. The board's not coming up with this.
But, you know, it is one of those conversations of at which point, not just our comparables, but let's see statewide. What is this really?
Yeah.
What's the state law really say in comparison to what's actually happening?
I wouldn't mind looking at the 9 statutorily comparative counties because they're population based, so you can kind of look at, you know, well, I would say Benton County probably does charge a construction excise tax. The whole community is around education. But frankly, their economy can probably afford it too. Theirs is all subsidized by, you know, kids going to school, government grants. That economy has a foundation that transcends economic woes. I know it does. And ours doesn't. still are having trouble recovering. So, anyway, another conversation. Did you have anything else?
No, that was it for me. So
thank you so much,
Mr.
O'Hare. Thanks. You had something?
I asked a question about the budget on community corrections this morning. I heard back there was two positions in the treatment that got put on that one item. They said they'd fix it for next week. So that made sense of why the manager was paid less than that other position. It's because there was two positions. Separately, AOC Housing Committee put out an invitation. Their normal schedule of meeting for AOC this month for a housing subcommittee is on November 3rd. But Portland area is hosting a summit on Build Small, Live Large. Essentially, it's an accessory dwelling unit summit. They were actually saying, should we go to this summit instead of attending the housing committee? I forwarded it to you, Commissioner Hare, as the liaison to planning. Personally, I would like to see our rural accessory dwelling policy change statewide that allows permitted accessory dwellings.
So she brought it, I don't know if you were here last week, and she's going to be working on an accessory dwelling unit issue now because they messed up and allowed the rural parts that wasn't, they're doing a legislative fix next February. She has this idea, and I don't disagree. I don't know how much merit it has, but let's get it on the books, adopt it in our RLDC, because that's what the state law says we can do right now. And then, like a provision of being grandfathered, hey, we did it. It's here. We're going to be applying it. We've got applications in the queue for it. Sorry, state, you kind of messed up, but thank you very much for doing what we asked you to do. So I think it's along those lines. I told her, I said, I'm tired of the state being an impediment to doing what we want to do here to solve our local problem. They're supposed to be facilitating a solution to these things, not being an impediment.
Director Schmelzer is going to the summit.
Good.
But I wanted to bring it up to you guys publicly, why I forwarded to you. I cannot attend, but
might,
it is a passion.
I might be in Portland already for that Forest Collaborative Working Group thing.
Okay.
I'm going as the public lands chair for AOC and the vice president for ONC. Tim Freeman was also delegated to go because he's going to be saying the stuff that I have to be a little bit more tempered. He's the bad cop this time. I'm the good cop. Sounds like a riveting meeting.
Yeah.
4 hours of my life I'll never get back.
Well, this sum,
need to be in the room.
This sum is the 3rd, 4th, and 5th, so I just wanted you guys to be aware in case somebody wanted to go. So, and it's a full week. There, you'd have that summit a week, and then the next week's AOC.
Mr. Young?
I would like to. I've been struggling for a while with Rogue Workforce Partnership. I have yet to figure out what that's all about. I'm on the board of directors. It's myself and Commissioner Dyer, chair and vice chair. I have been to 4 meetings. And absolutely nothing has gotten done in 4 meetings. I don't understand what they talk about, argue about. Why is it that a county commissioner has to sit in at every one of these meetings and be a chair or a vice chair? Because it alternates back and forth.
Yeah.
Who delegated that? Who said, do they have a charter that says it
probably
needs to be? Because I would like to resign from Road Workforce Partnership. It is a real pain in my schedule. Everything's in Medford, or I get to sit down and it takes us 20 minutes to get the thing on the screen.
No.
And it's not our stuff here.
Yeah.
It's their stuff there. And then we get all down and there are 2 things on the agenda that don't mean anything at all to me or anything else. If Rogue Workforce and the unemployment and all them are working together, I don't need to be officiating their meetings. I stepped down as chair and Commissioner Dyer said, well, I'll take it because I live in Medford and I'm a half a block from there and I'll walk down. But I don't know what they get done that requires a county commissioner to be in the room at every phase. I don't mind being their liaison.
I hear you.
In keeping in touch with them, but I don't want it mandatory. Like today, there's a meeting this afternoon, and it's either I drive to Medford or I try to get it on that thing.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's another half an hour, 45 minutes of my life I won't get back, and I don't understand any of it and what it has to do with the Board of County Commissioners.
I'll work with Arthur and Wally on what we could do about that thing. I've been in part of that for a while and stuff. And I want to give it more time. I frankly have to use the restroom, and I don't have the capacity to really think about what our options could be right now. So I'll work on it, though.
Please.
I will. Anything else? I had other stuff, but I really can't concentrate.
I understand that. Do we want to take a pause for a couple
it's
seconds?
It's up to you guys.
Let's just take a pause then. So I'll put it on pause at 11:30.
Great. We're back in session at 11:36.
So that was the only thing I had was the Road Workforce Partnership thing. And if we can get some determination on that, I'd appreciate that.
Well, it's a little outside my scope to actually address this problem. I don't mind doing it, but it feels...
If you want me to do it,
I don't know that it's not fair. I mean, you don't have the history with the transitions of how they've gone through the iterations of different... You know,
Job Council,
combined,
Workforce.
Then they were separated. Now they're back around.
And that's all well and good, but I just don't see...
Really, what I'm going to do is come up with a recommendation about an abbreviated meeting schedule or a hybrid executive oversight committee that only needs to get together twice a year for the higher level vision approval, like what we did for community corrections. You lay out the chart for the charge for the year, and that's what you're going to do. I don't need to be. You don't need to be. The county doesn't need to be involved with the day-to-day management of
exactly.
the program.
I think that's my concern.
There are also the other option.
Every 2 weeks, and I get just loaded and loaded about.
See,
oh,
the other option is to put that under like the jurisdiction of SOAR-Ready or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think they're in the buildings together, or they're down the street. They need to be. They're under the same auspices as the goal of economic development.
Well, and they're at the same table when I went to the regional solutions meeting. They're there, too. So yep. it's duplicating meetings. But I would suggest the first place is that we need to ask. I'm having some concerns about another agency that we're an intergovernmental agency agreement on. And so what I asked for was the authorization or whatever you call it, the agreement itself, mm-hmm. the bylaws or whatever, to see what was the format of the group created to be.
Right.
Let's have that conversation of what's
intent.
Correct.
What's the intent?
So let's, that's where I would suggest we start, okay. is whoever's there say, show me the bylaws, email me the bylaws, let's have a discussion about what it's meeting with, and
we need to sit down with Rick Dyer because I'm sure he's struggling with the same issue.
Yeah,
and Rick Dyer, Commissioner Dyer.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
Well, nobody wants our time wasted, and what are they accomplishing by meeting?
Yep. Okay.
Exactly. I think, and right now, SOAR-Ready and Road Workforce are butting heads. And I tried to get them together to do a joint project. Why are you doing this when SOAR-Ready is doing the exact same thing?
Yeah.
And you're both using funds to be, well, no, we don't get along. So what? Yeah, in fact, one of them is so ready, he's moving out of our building and it's going to put us in. I go, I don't want to get in this cat fight.
No.
I really don't want to be in because I am on so ready. And if so ready has an agenda, when we meet, it's 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and you get something done in that time. This, it's just... A lot of this, and I don't like that. A lot of jabber that really doesn't come to a head at the end of the day.
I'll work on it.
Okay, thank you.
It's because I like you.
That's it.
It's because I like you.
Good.
We'll get it done. Commissioner Morgan?
I'm not ready to bring this one back to you guys, but I did just get some documentation. I'll bring it back when it's time to talk on this one.
Okay.
I can't recall if there was anything else.
So our schedule should be on our administrative workshop board business type of thing. Every administrative workshop. I think we need to plan one out for the rest of the year from a standpoint of holidays, the annual meeting for AOC, the annual meeting for ONC, mm-hmm. and such. So it's getting to that time of year where there's not a whole lot of time left to do stuff, but scheduling things for the next year like this State of the Union type of address that we would want to do this year, next year, whenever it works best, by our opinion. All these things take time to organize, put together and stuff, and somebody needs to do those and get them on the schedules and move it forward. So, and ideally, I wouldn't mind... I think I've heard expression of some challenges with the Cannabis Advisory Committee, which I anticipated. I just think that there's probably a balance, and I think it's been brought to your attention about how much involvement from the liaison and just figuring out. I think charting the course from the beginning, there's going to be a lot of involvement by you as liaison.
My intent wasn't to continue at that level.
I think that's people's fears, is there's a driving direction more so than letting the expertise of the panel kind of come through. And
the concern that I had, so for this last meeting, it was specifically emailed to me by numerous people in the community that there was going to be an attempt to basically hijack the meeting. And also, there are people on the committee that have agendas, and they've stated they have agendas.
Very outspoken
people. Why they're
there? Well, no, it's not. It's not why they're there.
It's not why they're supposed to be there.
It's not their
platform
to express those issues. They have other opportunities in other places to push those agendas. In this case, they're there because we saw that they had expertise on a topics that we're trying to get.
Well, and in my opening statement out at the fairgrounds, I told them, I said, you need to leave those agendas at the door, as we do at RV Act. That's your direction. I hope you can do that.
Well, and one participant was flat out, has made it clear, both, I actually took a screenshot of a statement on Facebook last night. Let's see. We were called, the reason why we're even here is because all the commissioners are prohibitionists, was the statement in the meeting. And then putting up posts, had taken the public information request list that Director Schmelzer put out and had put those everywhere on Facebook and responded that I put a few days ago listing both actual violations going back 10 years that are still open and the list of alleged cannabis cultivation sites. The RR problems myth is busted, and so is the BCC and planning's narrative. So I question having somebody on the panel that's specifically out to challenge the narrative of the BCC or the intent of the BCC. I think that may become a problem, that somebody is using this panel as a means of challenging the commissioners or taking out a process. And I flat out have said that's not their role.
Yeah, I don't mind their public opinion, though. And it's when they're doing it in the capacity of being a panel member. And there's a balance between letting, you know, if you get notice that there's somebody who's going to hijack the meeting, and then it perceived that you, yes, potentially headed that up, but nobody knows that they were going to do that, and then you're perceived as the person who hijacked the meeting because they never were given the opportunity. And there's a balance between that of saying, sometimes it'd be fine to let, you know, you let the kid act out a little bit.
So the only one I acted out against were members of the public that were speaking out.
No.
There was no panel as I shut down.
I haven't reviewed it, actually.
Chris Hall and Mark Seligman spoke up to challenge things. And they were told no. And afterwards, the mayor of Cape Junction actually looked at Chris and said she was right in stopping you.
The public isn't supposed to engage.
That's what my statement was. And they continue to engage. Yeah. And I said, if you don't stop, we'll have to take a recess. Yeah. If you want to continue to let the panel discuss, then you should stop so they can do their business. Otherwise, we'll stop the meeting. That was my interaction.
I don't think that's what people were being critical about. So.
Well, then I would suggest you listen to the meeting first. The conversation I did not lead. It was the chair leading the conversations and asking people, calling on people back and forth. At one point, two panel members started arguing on whether or not we should be doing anything with RR, if there was a problem or not. And I suggested, instead of you two getting caught up on there isn't, let's move past that so it doesn't derail the conversation. And I had suggested that the panel saying, I said, you don't have to come up with a recommendation, but the board is going to do something. So if you don't want to come, you know, it was kind of basically, but the only time I had expressed any force of sorts was when a member of the audience called a point of order.
Yeah.
I had already happened to have had the mic in my hand, and I stopped. And then a second member of the...
They don't work for the public. They work for you. They work for the board. And you're their employer, so to speak.
Yeah.
They serve at the pleasure. And telling the public to them, this is not your time or your role. You are not guiding this issue here. You are. And that's totally appropriate.
So I would. I mean, the first hour of the meeting was water.
Yeah.
Well, and there was presentations and such, and then the next the chair led for one of the panelists to give a presentation. There was conversation back and forth.
Yeah.
And then he said, "Will you give an update of where we're at?" And you know, because there was different text presented that day.
Yeah.
And that I presented to them, and then. You know, afterwards it was challenged. Well, you're not letting the panel create the agendas. And I said, every panel and committee in the county, a staff person creates the agenda with the exception of mining, that their secretary and chair create that. I said, but nothing that we've done has not been in conjunction other than the first meeting that was business. The second one was created before that meeting. These agendas were set with staff and the chair.
Yeah, the staff and the chair. And, you know, committee build was on one of the agendas that I helped craft. I said, you need committee build. Next meeting, committee build. I don't know if that was on the first agenda, if it's on subsequent agendas. That's the committee's job, mm-hmm. is to say, what are you going to talk about next week? Well, we didn't get to X, Y, and Z. Let's talk about it.
So every meeting, they've been told, if you have an agenda item, give it to the staff member, and the staff member and the chair will get those things scheduled. And that's what's happened so far. And I was challenged by one of the citizens afterwards, Chris Hall, and it's something Mark has said, that I'm controlling all the agendas. Well, no, the only agenda I controlled was the one that we set with Rob Bovet, because that was the first one created, and then the business one first. The next agenda was created by the staff member, not me. And the chair and I, the chair came in to speak with me, and we invited a couple people to speak at his recommendation.
Well, and they seemed relevant to the issue, so I don't see the error.
Well, and let me clarify, the assistant water master that spoke came out of the very first meeting, a request from a panel member.
Yeah.
One of the panel members submitted a topic that was on that agenda. So every agenda build has been based on request. There is also a request of one of the panel members to have the Williams Citizens Advisory Committee come present, and they're wanting to have the panel make a recommendation of an order for the board to approve. I don't know if this is the right venue for that, or if that is. If there's a group of citizens in the community that wants something brought before the board, and it's cannabis-related, does it go through the panel? Or if it's land use, does it go through planning? Or does it go straight to the board?
The jurisdiction has really been defined to say that it doesn't, but really is that the bang for the buck and the time and effort that needs to be used wisely? The culture is, for me, the big one. And maybe that has a nexus with the Williams issue and the CAC's recommendation, but it feels like they went through this one tact and it wasn't reinforced by the citizenry, and now they're trying a different avenue to probably get to the same end game. And that's not unlike human nature to try to, you know, just try different ways to get there.
And I'm so they've been offered to, you know, we'll get you on the list to go kind of go from there. They're pushing that they get the next meeting because they think it's timely for before the commissioners do something. So it's one of those things that my intent has not been to control this advisory panel, but it has been to set the tone of, this is going to be an organized, your way of getting something on the agenda is to go through the staff member and the chair and the staff member, all those.
Well, that all sounds good. So
anyhow.
Well, anything else? Because we got 10 minutes and I like to be on time.
when we come up in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and we've got our text amendments like we've hammered out yesterday or something fairly close to that, what's going to be the kickback from the panel? Are they going to say, why are you doing this? We haven't had one constructive meeting yet. Not one. We've had presentations to us, but not very much coming from us.
Well, and that's
then
what
all
they,
of a sudden you're going to just go ahead and do it anyway.
They wanted to wait several weeks.
And I don't want to wait several weeks, so I'd like to know where they're at.
So I told them at the last meeting, this will be your last opportunity to talk on this topic, that the commissioners are moving forward.
Well, that's not necessarily true. They'll have the public right, just like everybody else, to present.
In the panel.
As a panel.
And as a panel, one of them made a motion to support the presentation the panelists made, and it was a vote of 5-3, one abstention. And it moved forward. Now, one of them since has come back and said, I don't agree with how I voted. I want to, you know, change this conversation. I still don't think the commissioners have a right to keep going. We need to have more time. But, and that's an opinion in the public of, well, if we created a cannabis committee, why are we going forward with this, these ordinances if you're not giving them time to hash it out?
But now that we have things fairly well hammered out, how far off, in your estimation, how far off are we from what they want? I don't think we're that far off, because we're hearing from the CAC that, you know, that this is, you know, pretty much what we're after, and, you know, from various people that are in the industry, that we're not that far off. We're, you know, we already told everybody we're going to put something together, and there will be some regulation. We're not going to just let be this unregulated mess that we had in 2016.
The Cannabis Advisory Panel was not established, from my perspective, with the intent to craft land use laws. There's already a committee that we have appointed to do that. They reviewed it. We've gone through the process. Mm-hmm. They have provided input. It is flawed or not complete. That's okay. You know, this isn't the last cannabis related text amendment we may ever do.
You're right.
And so there's other opportunities for us to get this right, more right. We can make amendments to this ordinance even before it's adopted in 90 days. If we say, you know what, there's a little tweak that we need to do, we can tweak this ordinance before it goes
right
into effect. So I'm not worried so much about, you know, that everything has to be perfect and everybody weighed in. We've been doing this for 3 years, you know, so it's going to be a constant progression to better
regulation. And maybe this is the opportunity that we flex our muscles, so to speak, say, no, this way we're going to do it because we're the board. You serve as the player of the board, and the board says this is what's
there
going to
are 100 other issues dealing with cannabis that should be addressed, you know. The code
this,
enforcement.
This is just the groundwork.
I think one of the topics is, should be the nexus of the code enforcement. You've got an attorney, you've got an officer, you've got a code enforcement officer and all that stuff. What does that look like for you guys? No, you guys messed up. You needed two code enforcement officers and only a half-time deputy. Or you need four deputies and you only need, you know. Because the school issue was something, I think, that there's 100 different issues that the cannabis panel should be looking at. I do have to go.
Thanks,
I will be on time. Nothing further. We're adjourned and we will reconvene next Tuesday, I think, is our first meeting.
Did you say what time it is?
Oh, I didn't. It's 11:53.